Welcome to the Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. I have a confession to make. We screwed up. Dr. Parker Mott and myself, who is the guest on this this show again, well, we recorded a 2-hour and 15-minute podcast with no sound. But we were lucky enough for the first time, we actually streamed the podcast live from inside the Cognitive Cave, live on Facebook. So Steve, being the genius man he was, did the best he could, and he was able to pull the audio from Facebook Live so we could post it now on the podcast. So I apologize if the sound quality bothers you. We will do our best to make sure that never happens again. But I urge you to please still push through and listen if it does bother you, because the information that's in this podcast provided by my friend Dr. Parker Mott is priceless. He is a psychologist. He is a practicing psychologist. He's my friend. He's a great guy. I love sitting down with him anytime. Been a while since we caught up, but it was good to have him back in studio for sure. But before we get to the show, a couple things to tell you. Dollar Mental Health Club is coming soon. It will be coming out in March. We'll be launching our beta test. We finished the alpha test back in September with great results and great things. So we made some tweaks, made some adjustments, and we'll be launching the beta test coming in March. So pay attention to that, but it's different. A lot of people are having trouble understanding, but this is mental training. It's not therapy. It's not counseling. We do 15-minute, 30, 45, and 60-minute sessions. But what it's about is about practicing in the present. We provide 4 target focus areas: personal, relationship, social, and business. And in those categories, you simply pick your target focus area, pick how long you want to train, pick your trainer, set your appointment, your date and time convenient to you, and we call you. And what we do is at the end is we're training you using research of psychology, sociology, all over the place. But the idea is to practice in the present with mindfulness, but literally giving you a tool and a strategy to apply in the present. Not talking about your feelings and not doing psychoanalysis, but this is mental training. It's kicking your front door mental training. You're dealing with something. You set the appointment. We hit you up. We give you a tool and a strategy for that moment so you can go on about your day. DollarMentalHealthClub.com is where you go. If you're interested in being a mental trainer, go to DollarMentalHealthClub.com and submit your information. Go to drinkmycoti.com after you go there. You see the little stutter there? Go to drinkmycoti.com. pH balance is beautiful. It's some of the cleanest water you can get. And it's a dose of mushroom probiotics. Trust me, you already know. Probiotics, they're good for you. You need them. Gut health, brain health, poop health, all that kind of health. And it's beautiful, beautiful, clean water. But Drink My Coti, Nectar of the Gods, Alfred, Sebastian, and crew down south in Florida. Love you all. Keep doing what you're doing. But you all, try it. Order it. Don't knock it till you try it. Go to drinkmycoti.com. Lastly, the second edition of The Cognitive Rampage, A Dose of Authentic Revelation, by yours truly, will be out in about 30 days or so. A lot of changes, a lot of revision, tons of edits. It's a theoretical perspective, so I will be continuing to revisit this book, make adjustments, point out my own biases, update the research, etc., etc. So if you bought the first edition of The Cognitive Rampage, please, please, please email me at cognitiverampagepodcast@gmail.com, picture proof that you bought the book, and I will send you, I'll email you a free electronic copy of the second edition of The Cognitive Rampage Podcast, A Dose of Authentic Revelation Revisited, for free on the house for buying the first book. So please let me know. I already made the excuse about the podcast, about the sound. I feel bad. I want to like keep telling you like, oh, but the information is valuable. It's quality. Everyone needs to hear what Dr. Parker Mott's saying here, but if you can, look him up to it. Counseling and Psychological Services of Central Florida. Check my boy out. Whatever you need. He's the guy. He's the guy. Technically, he's kind of my therapist, the way you look at it, huh? Kind of feels that way, huh? Yeah. All right. But I hope you enjoy this. Tons of mental health information in here, bringing us up to date on neurology. We walk through diagnosing. We actually even discuss free will. Is there free will or is there not free will? We cover a lot of array of topics generally when Dr. Parker Mott is on the show. But I hope you enjoy. I hope the sound quality doesn't bother you too much. Please push through it if you can. We'll make sure that it doesn't happen like that again. Thank you so much for sticking around and listening to us and sharing what we do. I love you. And if you haven't found us, please look up the Tribe of Change. It's a closed private group on Facebook. Ask to join us, and you'll see what we're doing, what we're all about. But shout out to the Tribe of Change. I love every one of you all. Wish I could shake your hand and hug you, every one of you, even the ones not in the tribe. Wish I could hug you all. But enough rambling. Let's get to the actual information and the stuff that's actually helping people out. This is my friend, Dr. Parker Mott.
Cognitive Rampage podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. I know I've been. You been?
I did.
Hashtag I've been. Welcome. This is the first podcast live stream on Facebook where we're in the cognitive cave and recording the podcast. And I think it is fitting that the guest that's on is my boy, backcountry doctor himself, Dr. Parker Mott, because you and Eric Rittenberry are the first guest ever on the Cognitive Rampage podcast.
That's right. I seem to be the one that's called to be the first of many of your adventures.
Oh, yeah. Called to many. That kind of scares me.
I think it's a test subject. That's what I am.
I think you caught on to me, man. I think you are. Eric Rittenberry caught on to me, though, because he doesn't come back anymore. I don't think you're going to come back, Eric, are you?
I don't know. Well, we're going to have to work harder to get him back in.
Yeah, I don't think he's...
We need to switch to more political topics.
Oh, my gosh. I couldn't wait, man. Just sit and let him go. But I think it's right that you're back on for this one. And I love it when you come to the podcast because not only is he my boy, cheers, by the way. Good to see you, man.
Cheers. It's good to catch up.
It's been a little too long, man.
Way too long.
But you always bring, like, notes and shit. You make me feel like I'm a piece of shit. I'm like, man, I have not done my research on this. I must have a beer then.
I have just a few scribbles this time. I do have two books, but normally I have much more in the way of preparation. I figured that this time we can just start with a couple of topics because everyone knows we're no lacking for topics in the world right now.
Yeah, well, I think I posted on there when we first started that I think the first, I even had to check the spelling. Don't tell anybody. But neuroscience and some new research you were bringing to the table. Does that sound like a place to start?
I think that's a good place to start.
But we hear about it all the time, right? That's like the new low-fat diet is neuroscience this and brain imaging this. We hear that all the time. So what's new on the front? Bring it to me.
Well, I think the reason why that is happening is that we're seeing a paradigm shift once again in the field of psychology, where we've gone from, the medieval times types of, psychology that we all kind of joke about and look back on the history of psychology and cringe at, to more, Freudian type of things, into CBT and different theories. And I think the progression of research and has focused more on the structural brain now. So I think a lot of the newest technology in terms of brain scanning is linking a lot of what the brain does to behaviors. So I believe that there's going to be a paradigm shift if it hasn't already happened. In a lot of ways, I do believe it has. Even in terms of the medications that are prescribed are designed or focused on the brain. So part of it is probably a combination of the research along with the new medications out.
All right, man. Now it is true
that quickly.
Yeah, all right. You see a lot of it's the mechanistic approach, right? That scientific mechanical approach, right? Which I like going at and say, okay, if we understand that feelings, thoughts, etc., are coming from the brain, mm-hmm. then the more we need to study the brain and how it's working mechanically. That's kind of what you're saying, right? What areas do what, etc. But I mean, the truth is we really only know what this. 2-3% of, we don't even know what there is to possibly know right now, right?
You know, we're having new discoveries every day, and, sometimes I watch the news, and some of the stories that are reported, I say, what we really need to be reporting are these new developments that we're discovering in medicine and in the brain every day that there's some very exciting connections out there to behaviors, feelings, the mind, how it works, and they're continually learning new things that could change the, you know, mankind, what we know about man, what we know about our species in general. And, you know, it's not getting out there quite like I would hope.
Yeah. Well, I say a lot of shit about the brain on here, even though that's not my realm, right? So I'm going to go ahead and gut check myself here live to see if what the shit I'm saying is true, all right? Hey, what's up, big brother? My brother, live on Facebook. What's up, Atia? Sitting on the beach in California, big brother. All right. Is there any brain scanner imaging at all that can prove any mental health diagnosis?
No.
Fuck yeah. Woo! Point fucking Adam, science and other motherfuckers talking shit. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it comes back to...
Okay, can we repeat that? Actually, you say it. You're the doctor. You say it.
There is no mental brain scanning imaging or anything that can definitively basically identify a diagnosis.
Bam, bitches. You heard that? You heard that? If anybody has a rebuttal, please email us. CognitiveRampagePodcast@gmail.com, and I'd be more than happy to entertain you. Okay, proceed, sir. So... I mean, how do they know how to design the drugs for where? I know that's not your field. I don't want to take you to the medical part, really. But, I mean, you said that they're designing these drugs based on the brain, even though we know little.
Mm-hmm.
And none of the brain imaging can really prove it. How do they design these at all?
Well, I think even with things like physiology and medication, it still fits as a theory.
Okay.
You know,
okay,
yes,
sure.
We're developing new information and new science and new research every day that's discovering more things about the brain and how medications do work. But at the end of the day, it still fits a theory. You know, that the serotonin theory, that, you know, serotonin is in related to mood and things like that. And to this point, all the research does show that. But, you know, in our history, our research has shown a lot of different things that have been, you know, proven to be incorrect as well.
Yeah.
So I think what we're doing is, just like everything in terms of research, we discover something and then we research more and we narrow things down. And I think that's probably what's going on with the brain right now, is we're making those new discoveries related to medicine and the brain structure, and narrowing down, you know, diving deeper into it.
Yeah, I like that perspective better, right? It's the only, my only issue is that people are the guinea pigs as we narrow it down, as we give them psychotropic medications. We're like, hey, take this shit.
Yeah.
You have what we think subjectively is this, and we think that this works subjectively in all this functioning of a brain that we don't know much about,
right.
But it's the level of treatment. So what's new?
Well, you know, that's...
But you're right, we got to do it, though,
we
right?
have to. That's,
yeah.
Since the beginning of man and
cool
science
view?
And going all the way back to Roman times, I mean, that's... Man is the
like
ultimate.
That. Dude, I like that perspective. It helps me. Well, it helps me lighten up on the
yeah.
prescription side, because I don't want to be that person that's anti-pill. Because when you
right.
need it, you fucking need it, right?
Oh yeah, no, there is a place and time for it. You know, I think it's always a personal choice and should be a personal choice. But people need to get the accurate information out there, whether that's a choice that they want to make. And you know, with the people who I see, traditionally, we start out with therapy and we make, you know, quite a bit of progress or teach them skills that they need. And then at times they need a little bit extra of a boost to help use some of those skills. And everybody's different. And, you know, medication isn't for everybody. Not everybody has to have medication. But I think it needs to be an option that people are educated about. And I don't think there's enough education about psychotropic medications out there.
Yeah, and for the rate that they're giving them out, you know. And for me, I love the idea of the brain. Now that, you know, shout out to the neuroscientists, the ones doing the research, because for me, it's like the final frontier, you know. Mechanically speaking, you know, medically, I think as a species, as a race, we are, and the science, we are just so far advanced, mechanically speaking, right,
mm-hmm.
that we can attach it on, we can grow back bones with,
okay.
you know, I mean, mechanically speaking, holy shit, you know, what we can do. But, you know, the chemical side, you know, is there any way to measure the amount of dopamine or serotonin in somebody?
You know, I think there's differing ways that they look at. I think one of the ways is looking at the electronical impulses in the brain, you know, the electronical signals, the connections in certain areas of the brain in which they're more illuminated in the scan suggests different types of activity. And that's one of the places where they look at the chemicals in those parts of the brain that are causing those that electrical currency going through. And, you know, that's part of, you know, somebody does a certain behavior, feels a certain way, and they can see those on the scans now.
That's why it's research,
dream activity,
right?
Yeah.
That's why it's neuro research, right? That's why it's more practice, right, than this than this exact science.
Well, with all research, I mean, it's, you know, causation, correlation doesn't equal causation.
Yeah.
And that's the premise by which most research goes through is that, you know, hey, you know, we see this on an imaging scan, and we see this behavior, this feeling, but that doesn't mean that this causes that, or does this cause the other?
Right.
You know, is it vice versa? So I think that's the area where people, research is being cautious, you know, that they're finding some really cool discoveries in terms of neurological research, but, you know, you don't want to put it as causation, like, you know, this part of the brain makes this happen.
I like how you said that. You said the researchers are being cautious, but it seems like the pharmaceutical companies are not being cautious. You know, I had a guest on, Dr. Andrew Hill, who does a lot of this neuroimagery and stuff, and he explained what they do, which I definitely saw science too, where they have a large database of, you know, 10,000 so brain images, all that have certain diagnosis. You know, he was particularly talking about ADHD as being one of the closest ones to actually find in a brain image. He talked about a gathering of something at a at an area of the brain, and they knew this just by, like you said, was matching it to a database of people they had. And for me, I saw that as very logical, you know. So for me, even though I may point out the obvious seeming to me and you the errors of the neuroscience world of and pharmacology, but I do want to point out that that is the final frontier. Like those are the people going, we think, you know, maybe we're, you know, other than the space and all the shit out there, but, you know, the human body.
Right.
You know, so my hat's off to those that do that. And I understand, you know, to that. I get it. It's a practice. It's a research. It's a theory.
And I think part of it is more people need to learn a little bit about the neurological side of it, because I think that's where a lot of it's going to be in the future, is these discoveries. I mean, that is where it's the center of the body. You know, all things are controlled from there. So and how little we know about it. So I think, yeah, we all need to. And then I talk about, that's the type of thing that needs to be advertised on news, is, hey, we discovered this today about the brain, and get people fired up about it, because everybody is going to have to change their view on life based off of some of the research that's being found.
Yeah, I'm with you. I do. I think it is exciting, you know, when you do learn something, and it's not advertised. I mean, can you imagine if, tonight at 11, not the killer who's waiting in your parking lot, we'll bring you more information in 3 hours. If it's really like, hey, guess what they discovered about your brain today?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it makes people think, and I think that would be an important part for people to understand their own thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. I think everybody in this world has questions about themselves, and these discoveries are being made that could educate people about themselves, and they're not being discussed or not being put out there for the general public to learn. I think the people who are inquisitive, sure, they go a little bit deeper, just like, you know, intellectual people will go deeper and read specific things, but I think it's the general public that we need to reach out to and talk about in the brain.
Yeah, since I'm always kind of pointing out the flaws and things when you see it, it's just kind of a reminder. What is new, though? What's on the cusp? What's coming out in neuroscience? Some of the stuff you text me about.
I think some of it is, a lot of it has to do with the new scanning materials, the new tools that they're using to measure different areas of the brain. You know, the MRI has always been around to measure structure, which they do find things like structural differences in, people who have ADHD. And,
what kind? Do you know? Can you go further there?
Well, for one, ADHD is one where they feel like, a good part of the issues are in the frontal lobe system. which is in charge of executive functioning, planning, things like that. And they do find differences in a lot of different people's brains. Obviously, no brain is the same, but they're finding, you know, basically patterns. People's patterns are, you know, things like homosexuals, transgender. They find differences in different areas, and I think that is something that, you know, the public needs to know as well, is that, you know, the whole issue about, is this choice or are they born like this?
I would say,
well, you know, they're born like this.
Right, well, people say that, and I think, I mean, I can see where they, I don't know how many initials, so I don't want to be disrespectful, but I really can't keep up, but I mean that whole side, I can see that research as being something you'd want to point out, to say, see, we fucking told you, you know, as opposed to say, hey, that's offensive.
Well, I think that is an area of, you know, just like I said, we need to get the information out there to the general public so that we can dispel some of these prehistoric myths about things and educate people. And if they choose to dislike a certain race or sex or classification of people, they do it at least with the correct information
they have,
and not just, hey, you know, you're choosing to, you know, have a sex change to be a man or a woman simply because you're a freak.
Or avoid prosecution for rear-ending somebody in a Range Rover.
Yeah.
That happened. I'm sorry, yes. No, but I wouldn't mean that. It's a ta-doom-tsh, allegedly. But, I mean, in order to have science back up like that, difficult of saying the brain is the operation or the foundation what's happening is the what I know about the powerful influence of epigenetic, the environmental influence, the shaping that our surroundings, you know, even not even our internal environment. I don't want to get to our internal thoughts yet, but just the epigenetic influence, you know, even before we're born, to the environment we're born into, you know, and how that argument, right? Does the brain shape us, or does the environment shape our brain that shapes us in return, right? That it's almost what nature versus nurture, nature, culture again.
And, you know, I think we have to take a step back, and we can't just say if it's this or that, it's both. You know, it's a combination of the two, that we've found that environmental factors do shape the brain, the actual chemistry and physiology of the brain, and biological factors also formulate and do the same as well. So I don't think we can narrow it down to just one. We are a combination of a multitude of different mistakes and anomalies and imperfections and perfect anomalies. And to get ourselves to be individuals, and every single one of us is different, and we're a product of our atoms and our experiences and our cells and everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, how could we ever really know? You know what I'm saying? So if you're studying, maybe you'd have to study a brain from birth all the way, and that would still only be one study.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? How could you even take into account and create an experiment or research that takes into account a person's perception of an experience of anything? To some people it's trauma, to some people it's not. You can give someone the same, you know, experience, like, yeah, it was Sunday. Yeah. And some people, like, are in therapy for years about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you, you know what I mean? I can't ever see an ability to put together an experiment to really say that it's 38.7% environmental influence from ages here to here, unless the sun's shining on it. You know what I mean?
I don't think there's any way that we will ever be able to measure quite the extent of each individual experience, which is why that we look more to meta-analysis, where we collect as much information on individuals as we can, and then we compare them against 2,000 other individuals.
Yeah.
So we look for patterns. And that's pretty much where, you know, psychological assessments are. You know, they look at people who are depressed and having a certain issue, versus someone else who takes a test who also has similar ones. So a lot of it is comparing.
Well, that's what we do, right? I mean, a lot of people say, well, we're different from animals because we have a thumb. And I'm like, well, that, and because we are amazing at deciphering patterns. Mm-hmm. We can pick out patterns so well that we create patterns that aren't even fucking there. You know what I mean? We're that sick. We're that good and we're that sick to where, like, yeah, I see that pattern and that, you know, soundproof behind you. It's up, down, we got a horizontal. I also know why, you know, on some bullshit philosophical perceptive level.
Well, I mean, patterns is the basis for things like racism and stereotypes.
No, you know, it's just...
You know, at the highest level, patterns we look at through research and, you know, statistical analysis and proven methods. And at the very bottom level, we look at, you know, stereotypes and in our own experience. And, you know, I think that's where the least valid perceptions come in is sometimes from our own self.
Mm-hmm. But it's the perception we value most. Because mm-hmm. it's ours.
It is. And it's. I think everybody tends to try and make patterns out of life because it's a means of survival. You know, it's a way of understanding life and trying to survive that we have to learn how to predict certain things in order to protect ourselves.
Yeah, I actually wrote in the book, actually the editor's like, take that shit out. I'm like, no. And where I went back, I tell the story of somewhere down the line, we sat around a campfire and we were hanging out at night and huddled together for some sort of protection. And the bush rustled, and next thing we know, our friend's not there anymore. Yeah. And we're like, holy shit, right? We see this flash, like, fuck. So the next time you're sitting around the fire, you're like, all right, we're going to be closer together. Our spears are up, right? When we hear the brush, you're ready. But don't forget, it could just be Bob, the neighbor, showing up. Right. So you know, but we respond, and you say survival, because it is.
And many times we can respond in different ways. Like, you know, Bob, who got snatched into the bushes, we recognize that, hey, you know, did you see what Bob ate for dinner today? Maybe that had something to do with it.
Well, okay,
and
yeah.
We make inaccurate attributions to why Bob disappeared in the bushes.
I love it. What? Yeah, Bob was drinking that fucking Stella that night. No Stella before campfires, you disappear, right? So, well,
that's the next thing you know, somebody's raising their children not to ever drink Stella because their buddy Bob disappeared after drinking it one night.
That's right, man. Shit.
So that's how inaccurate attributions get passed from people and superstitions.
You were talking causation.
Yeah.
Causality and causation.
Mm-hmm.
That's a circle right back to that same idea. And we create those same perceptions. And that's why I do like neurology and or neuroscience to go back to it, is because they're trying to make sense of the perceptive reality.
Mm-hmm.
Fucking good luck. You know what I mean? So I'm cheering for you. You know, I'm probably not going to see the day that they discover that, right? Maybe it's when we, you know, hit transpersonalism that this idea happens. But,
oh yeah,
you know, for them, that's really what they're trying to do, is make sense of the internal mystical mind chaos.
I think it's, you know, it's kind of like a CSI investigator. They're not going by, you know, hey, this guy's acting shady. They're looking at specific analysts of, you know, vials of blood and splash patterns and things like that. And I think that's what neurological research is trying to do and neuroscience is doing, is they're trying to look for more hard evidence of things. And they're making progress in some ways.
What's some of the progress? Well, I've asked like 7 times and then I scroll the fuck off. And like, we have no rush anyway. So I keep wanting to know, so what's new in the field?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of different things in the field. And in terms of therapy and counseling, which is something that I specialize in doing mostly of, is they're finding, you know, that there's more therapies out there that work for a variety of, you know, ways. You know, new things for depression, new CBT methods. There's one here in one of these books that talks, it's a computer-generated cognitive behavioral treatment for sleep insomnia.
I'm listening.
So,
what do we do?
Well, and that's, you know, a lot of the things out there in terms of research is looking at how computers play a role in things.
Yeah, what do we do? Am I, like, putting on a VR thing? I'm like, what does this method do?
Well, sure. I mean, there's things like that out there as well. But I think there's other stuff like computer-based therapies, social media therapies, the Dollar Mental Health Club, things like that.
Yeah, I get
paid extra for that, don't I?
You do, yeah. I'm sorry. So. Yeah, for sure. I'm going to get checked.
But no, I think, you know, they're looking more at therapy, but they're also recognizing that you know, that maybe therapy isn't the only treatment out there. And that's where it's kind of taking more into the brain. Is can we do something specifically in the brain, whether it's medications or whatnot, in order to help people?
Yeah. I saw it back when I was kind of, you know, I never imagined I could ever be a, you know, mm-hmm. doctor for one like you do, or much less into neuroscience at all. But I always saw that, you know, if I went further with the licensure or whatever, I said, mm-hmm. there's a way I got to cross over and get into something neurology. Like, I right. just felt like that's it. You know, mm-hmm. we've walked the Freudian consciousness level, right? And
yeah.
I love what Jacques Fresco, when he talks about the consciousness. He's like, we've discovered consciousness since Freud, and we've discovered nothing.
Mm-hmm.
We still know what we knew then. We've walked right. down no aisle. We've discovered nothing.
Well, I think what they're trying to do is make treatments faster, you know, if part of it is
imagine that
insurance.
We want to go fucking faster.
Yeah,
you pull all the shit out of the ground so we can go faster. What the fuck is the obsession with going fucking faster, man?
I think it's society. We've just sped up so much, and part of it is, you know, all over the world a little bit of that's happened, but America in particularly is always on the go. It's always about fitting more things in, moving things more efficiently. And I think things have become more efficient, things have become easier, but when things become efficient and easier, we can fit a whole lot more things in our day. And that's where we become overwhelmed a lot of the time. Is
have you seen a rise of anxiety diagnosis through your walk, through your practice? Through your
Anxiety is anxiety and panic disorder. Both of those are something that I see on a regular basis, and you know, probably more so than anything else. And it ranges from, you know, children, adolescents, you know, young adults, older adults. I mean, I can't even pinpoint an age range where I would see more of it, because it's just so prevalent throughout.
That's what blew me away when I moved from the clinic to community counseling. It blew me away how many fucking teenagers were coming through, I mean, under 16, with panic attacks, anxiety disorders. It was blowing me away, man. Like, I was seriously like, wow. You know, I've been in clinics working with adults for the last fucking 3 years. So you hit the community counseling, you're like, all right, break it up. I get to see it. It was just kid after kid, anxiety, pressure to make grades, right? And then if it wasn't a kid, it was the parent coming in going, my anxiety from the kids.
Right.
You know, it's like that old pot commercial where the kid's in the room trying to connect with dad, and the dad's in the other room trying to connect with kid, and they're both smoking weed out the window.
Right.
And you're like, fuck, if they only fucking knew. Now, I'm not advocating that.
Of course.
But I'm saying that's what it kind of seems like when I was in it. I'm like, I'm talking to the parent, I'm talking to the kid, I'm like, all right, we got to talk to each other here. You know, mm-hmm. But I did read an article that anxiety had finally surpassed the depression diagnosis
mm-hmm.
In this country.
Oh, absolutely. I believe the most recent statistic is 90-92% of all Americans have at some point met criteria for an anxiety disorder.
Okay.
Not to say all of, you know, 92 of everybody has it
right.
at that time, but at some point we all have.
Explain the criteria, because, yeah, I mean, I've quickly ran through it. I fed people the fire hose in my last, you know, mental health rampage about the DSM and all this other stuff and criterion. But I mean, you can probably explain it better of what that means.
Right. Criteria is basically, and the DSM is not perfect. It wasn't designed to be perfect. It wasn't designed to be specific. And I think a lot of people
just specifically to sell pills.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Sorry.
People take the book and they do use it for those purposes. But I think in terms of the DSM, it was never designed to be perfect, and I think people have tried to look at it through the eyes of medicine, which it's not the same as medicine. It's designed to be kind of an idea, kind of a framework that a clinician can sit back and say, okay, this is the diagnosis, and this person needs some of it, but not all of it, or they need all of it, but it's still not correct, where if it was medicine, either, you know, hey, there's cancer there. Guess what? You have cancer. Where with something like anxiety, it can be a number of different things. So they try and make it a little bit more fluid in some ways, where it a little more flexible, I guess. And that's where the DSM, I think, has some strengths, is that it does allow for some variations there. that simply just because you meet all the criteria doesn't mean you have the diagnosis. And I think sometimes that's where the problem comes in, is that diagnosing is not an exact science.
Wait, one more time.
Diagnosing is not an exact science.
All right, Steve, when you're going back over this, I'm going to need you to record and dub Parker out of that and put Dr. Parker Mott said.
Diagnosing is not an exact science.
Okay, proceed, sir. Unless it's a broken arm, cancer, or...
Sure. I think, you know, one of the most difficult things to diagnose is bipolar disorder. Yet it was, at one point, the most, you know, kind of the diagnosis du jour, the popular one out there where everybody was bipolar. And I think anybody who goes online can Google the DSM diagnosis for bipolar, and we all freak out that we have bipolar. But that's not the case. I think, and that's why I think there's some frustration, some anger, and a lot of misdiagnosis out there, is that you can read some of these diagnoses and attribute them to yourself and you not have them.
Well, we do, right? I reference in the book the Corvette syndrome, and even the on a date love syndrome is, you know, you... Wow, on the new floor here.
Yeah.
So if I'm, you know, say I'm in the market to buy a new car, I think in the book I reference the actual Corvette, where I say, look, if I'm thinking about buying a Corvette, which I would not, I don't need a, no offense if I drive a Corvette, but I don't need a penis extender. So, but if I'm looking to buy whatever car that is, for the next couple of days, all I see around town is that car. You know, I even use the rabbit, you go on a date, and you want to fall in love, maybe you're really trying to match up, and the person like orders what you do, and you're like, oh, it's fate. And the other person's like, there's two things on the menu. You know what I mean? And you're like, you know, you see what you want to see almost.
Right. It's a form of a bias. You know, things like confirmation bias, attribution bias. Right. You seek out information to confirm your own desires, beliefs, feelings, thoughts.
Yeah. So since we brought it up, we'll walk through it, because a lot of this lingo, people, you know, even sometimes myself, it just goes over our head. So walk us through what it really means, because people will Google bipolar, you know, diagnosis and criteria. So it may not even be correct. So what I have is, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I think with bipolar in particular, the diagnosis has changed greatly over the 40 years or so that.
There's eight of them coming out now, right? Bipolar 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, there's at least eight versions coming.
Well, they still have two, but there's different specifiers of each type, mixed episodes, hypomanic episodes. So there's a number of different, you know...
I have no idea what you mean.
And all of it... and all of it has different durations or intensities. You know, bipolar 1 seems a little bit more intense than bipolar 2. So I think that there's different levels of bipolar that when I was working in community mental health hospitals, you know, bipolar disorder was the guy who was arrested sitting naked in a tree singing at 3 o'clock in the morning and thinking he's Jesus.
Right, that was everybody's, perception of that idea. And even with schizophrenia, I remember before I even got into it, a perception that it was created by society, what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you meet, I was like, oh, this is my favorite patient. You know what I mean? They were so nice, you know, and fun to talk to, you know. And I almost envied sometimes how even schizoaffective, mm-hmm. you know, could be so in the now. It could be so in the present,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that to me is something I could look. So what I looked up was the diagnosis criteria. The criteria presented for the mood episodes that are significant in the diagnosis of bipolar 1 disorder, manic episode, major depressive episode, mixed episode. Criteria for both manic and major depressive episode are met, excluding duration, almost every day for at least 1 week.
Mm-hmm.
Walk us through.
That's
Latin for a lot of motherfuckers. What was that?
Mm-hmm. What that was basically explaining the duration and what's a manic episode. Yeah, a manic episode is characterized by a number of different criteria, such as elevated mood, increased goal activities, excessiveness in some ways.
No, it's pretty excessive, because when people think manic, sometimes they think I'm excited, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the example I always use when I try to explain a manic episode is like, mm-hmm. it's 3 a.m. and you decide to paint your house lavender. You get halfway through it, and then you decide, no, it's another color. And then this is how I used to try to describe for people what manic really meant.
Right, like, because just even the things that I just said, you know, elevated, expansive mood, goal-oriented. Sure, hey, we all need criteria for this, but when's the last time that you got into gardening and didn't sleep for 3 days because you were gardening?
Yeah, I laugh, but it's
true.
But in my head, I know the diagnosis, and then what people go is, yeah, I'm bipolar, and how quick, you know, a practitioner will just write that shit up, you know?
And I think, you know, psychiatrists, they don't quite assess the way they need to in a lot of ways, that bipolar disorder can look a lot like other things. You know, when a psychiatrist asks, you know, have you been sleeping much lately? And they say, no, I've only need about 3 hours of sleep. You know, and they can meet, you know, have you gotten any goal-oriented? How are you with spending money? How are you with sex? How are you with, you know, impulsivity? Oh, I'm real impulsive. So I think you're getting the reporter, you know, the person who's reporting the symptoms is answering the questions, but the psychiatrist or the doctor is seeing it through a different lens. So I think it takes, which is why it's so difficult to do, to make that diagnosis, is when I make that diagnosis, I do it over, you know, a good deal of history. Maybe not just the person who's telling me about it, but maybe their parents or friends or spouse, along with maybe some psych testing too, because bipolar disorder can look like a lot of other things.
How long should a diagnosis really take for a real proper assessment? For a genuine bipolar can claim disability, and I'm moderate, you know, what's that really entail? Is it a 7-minute day? Is it a 20 questionnaire? What is it really?
No, I think it is.
I know you're thorough as fuck. You do your shit, man. You know what I mean? You're
right.
Actually, by the way, don't forget there's somebody that needs to talk to you, actually.
Okay.
But go ahead.
Is it you?
No.
It is you.
I'm doing that right now. We're going to get to my therapy at the end of this shit. Right?
Okay.
I'm just not being selfish right now.
Right. I think it depends on the severity. You know, if it's easier to make a diagnosis of bipolar disorder if you're working in somewhere like a crisis mental facility where you're going to see somebody being picked up, you know, running naked down.
And severity would be easier to see.
Severity is easier to see. And that's, I think, where bipolar disorder gets messy sometimes, is that there's a lot of people out there who do have some form of bipolar symptoms. Do they meet the full criteria for, like, bipolar disorder or to that severity? No. But I think that's
how much of it is situational.
Exactly. Well, I mean, things like post-traumatic stress disorder can very much look like bipolar disorder. I think, you know, if you look at some of the symptoms of veterans coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan, they could very easily be diagnosed with bipolar disorder when it's post-traumatic stress disorder that they're experiencing. So I think there's a lot of overlap with some symptoms, even anxiety. Panic attacks, experiencing problems with anxiety where you're irritable, you're cranky, you've been anxious for a number of years, you're not sleeping well, stress, even stress can push people to exhibit symptoms of bipolar disorder. So you go into, you know, you're experiencing stress in your life or something going on, and you go into a psychiatrist and they diagnose you with bipolar disorder, and what it really is something related to a situation in their life or just prolonged stress.
So if somebody walks in and they're handed a 20 questionnaire thing and then talked to for 30 minutes and given a diagnosis,
I wouldn't do it. I know there are people out there who do that, but you know, depending on the particular diagnosis, there are people that I diagnose very easily with general anxiety disorder after meeting with them for, you know, an hour.
Sure.
Depression as well. It's pretty easy to pick out a lot of times.
What do you look for most when you're looking at depression? As you're, you know, assessing the person in front of you,
mm-hmm.
you know, what's one of the main things you're looking for first to kind of pick up on the tail of, all right, I'm going to walk this road mm-hmm. for a little bit?
Well, I think first I want to get into something called adjustment disorder with depressed mood.
Dude, I shit you not. I was in the middle of your rant. I was going to say, well, back when insurance forced me to have a diagnosis,
uh-huh.
my go-to was adjustment disorder.
Because
I didn't want to give anybody some harsh diagnosis when I knew they were just going through some shit.
You know, and I think that's a good thing to do. You don't want to assign somebody a major diagnosis that could possibly follow them around for some time and affect their future treatment, which some of that is a myth, some of that is true. There's no reason to be, you know, completely paranoid that a diagnosis is going to be, you're going to experience a lot of problems with that. But With depression, I think there is kind of a threshold. Adjustment disorder with the depressed mood is basically like something happened and I'm sad about it.
Yeah.
It's very basic.
So you're, I love
I lost my job. I've been out of work for a month.
You're beast.
And I'm depressed.
You're a beast, bro. Look, if you need to see a doctor, go see my boy, Dr. Parker Mott, he's in Winter Garden. But I mean that because as a practitioner, I'm watching how you diagnose. You're not diagnosed from severe down. You're starting with maybe it's the least lightest diagnosis.
Bottom up.
Fuck yeah.
And I do
that's how you do it, practitioner people. You do it like that. You go bottom up. You start adjustment, maybe disorder. You don't start with your fucking bipolar and don't. Notes. Notes. What's the practice name again?
Counseling and Psychological Services of Central Florida.
Yeah, fucking go there and Winter Garden. Okay, that's.
You can find me on Facebook, Twitter.
Yeah, was that a cell phone? That was a cell. I just read it in there.
www.counselingcfl.com.
No shame. No shame, you motherfucker. No shame. All right. But,
hey, I plugged your book.
Yeah, that's right.
So, and your website.
Fuck yeah. No, anytime, man.
No, man.
So when you're walking in, what's some of that sign when you're looking for adjustment disorder? Are you looking for behavioral signs, verbal signs? What are you looking at when you're watching?
Or first, I'm not looking for anything. I'm just open. I'm just open. I really do. When I first meet with somebody, I'm open to meeting somebody new. I'm open to sharing myself with them and them sharing themselves with me. So I'm not looking for anything. I'm just kind of listening to their experience because, after all, it is their experience. I'm not somebody who's going to sit there and, you know, analyze you, which I know a lot of people are, and that's a fear of somebody going in to see a psychologist is, oh, they're going to analyze me. I don't do that. I only do that for my friends like you.
Yeah. Oh, man, people, if you could hear what the fuck I get to hear when this show's over. I have so many issues I work through. But look, I have a free doctor. I just bring him on the show. I get therapy right here.
Exactly. So, but
what are you looking for? Like, when you're processing, because I know.
I look at, did something happen in your life? How long has it been going on?
Let's bring it to this show. Yeah. What's some of the first symptoms somebody's showing?
Well, of what?
Depression.
Of depression. You know, it's going to be things like fatigue, being tired, lacking motivation, not wanting to do things that they once used to do. I noticed that's a first one. Being more lethargic. I think the diagnosis is a little bit more biased towards women, too, that they tend to experience sadness and crying, which is one of the criteria in the DSM.
Oh, sorry. Elaborate, please.
Well, men tend to be more angry and irritable.
Yeah, so you're saying the depression diagnosis leans to favor to
women. Yes.
To heavy diagnosed toward women.
Yes, I do believe that, because I think the symptom of anger is something that you see in men, but also children. A lot of times the diagnosis is missed in children because they're exhibiting anger and behavioral problems when it's actually depression.
Because we could classify the symptom then as what? Irritability, right?
Irritability, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just snappiness. But I think there's a general kind of down there.
Well, a lot of child psychologists and practitioners, they tend to go through that, not adjustment disorder, but the resistive to social, you know, come on, help me out in a minute.
Keep going.
The basis of it would basically be when I almost had it. Is it discomfort, disruptive?
Dysthymic?
No, that's the other end of depression. More of a conduct disorder.
A conduct disorder like?
Like when they're acting out and being violent kind of type thing. They tend to lean toward those diagnoses. Like you said, a child may show that they're angry.
Oh, oppositional defiant?
Bam! Thank you, opposition defiant disorder. They start to lean toward that disorder when really, I love that you point that out, that the kid doesn't really know any other way to express it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that symptom begins to look like it's anger. We go down operational defiant when truly it's irritability coming off missed as depression.
Right. It very well could be. I think oppositional defiant a lot of times is that one's also sometimes difficult to rule out because the people who tend to have that are teenagers. And it's normal for teenagers to have a little bit of, you know, conduct or oppositional, a little bit of standoffish towards authority. So
definitely say that again for the parents listening, because they need to hear a doctor. Parents, listen, this is a doctor telling you.
It's normal for your teenager to be a little defiant.
Right. You didn't do anything bad. They're not fucked up. They're not rude. They only need to be taught a lesson.
Yeah, no, I think that is something that, you know, I think there is a progression with oppositional defiant that a lot of times you see a progression from ADHD into oppositional defiant, into maybe a conduct disorder, and then later on into a personality disorder. So they do find that there's kind of a connection between all those diagnoses in some form or another. But I think there's a level of oppositional defiant, which is normal and can be easily misdiagnosed if in the hands of our own clinician.
Yeah, should the clinician lean more toward the depression diagnosis or more toward the operational?
I think it's case specific. I think it should be case specific that, you know, is there a history of depression? Or is there a history in the family of depression? You know, is there any other factors going on such as trauma or something socially going on? So I think it's case specific. Everybody's an individual and everybody's brain is different.
Yeah, so we're back to the patient on the couch, right? So I love that, man, you're good at what you do, man. It's so fucking refreshing to hear a practitioner go, Adam, I'm not looking for anything. And I'm like, you fucking devil, I almost got you. And you're right on, that's right. So you're not looking for anything. But typically, at the beginning stages of some depression disorder, or even if adjustment depressive disorder, what's something, I'm trying to get some people to kind of, if they're wondering about their partner or their kid or something like that, you know what, I love the idea that they are not interested in things they used to be.
That's a big one, yeah.
Yeah, and because a lot of people go just not interested and tired, and you go, no, it's interested, tired, could be other things, nutrition, activity,
right.
But it's specific to what they used to love to do.
Mm-hmm. I think the next thing is,
how do they know though the difference between they're just the teenagers going, I just don't like that anymore,
right?
And you know, I can see where a parent would go, you know, they don't like that anymore, so it maybe they're heading that way. So what would be maybe something second that the kid or the adult even would lean toward?
Well, I think, you know, isolation. Are they spending time with their friends doing some positive social things, or are they not spending time with friends and withdrawing to their room? Seem to be a personality change where they've gone from somebody who's been bright and happy to someone who's a little darker or quiet or depressed looking, just kind of flatness to their look and their
that flat
constricted, yeah, constricted affect or flat affect.
That's a scary face when you see it.
It is, and I think you do have to look at those. Is there any other change in behaviors? You know, particularly the one to look for is hopelessness. I think hopelessness is one of the worst symptoms people can have because we all have been depressed in some ways. We all get down. We all get sad. We all go through our periods. But I think when we feel like things are hopeless and you cross that line into, you know, hey, things aren't going to get better, then things such as, you know, thoughts of suicide can kind of come in and, you know, hopefully not actions, but a lot of times that is a precursor to it. Is that, you know, it's one thing to say, hey, you know, things have sucked yesterday and they kind of stink today, but, you know, I think they'll get better eventually.
Yeah.
Versus saying, you know, things were horrible yesterday and things are bad today. And you know what? Tomorrow and next week and the future is also going to be terrible.
Yeah, that's sad, man.
That is.
Hopelessness. Mm-hmm. So some of the stuff you brought, though, some of the CBT stuff, what's some of the stuff that, you know, that's new that's popping up for depression, for whatever else?
Mm-hmm.
What's some of the give me some of the competence.
Well, I think with cognitive behavioral therapy, it's something that's a little bit more concrete and not quite as abstract of a...
I'll get you, Paloma.
Not quite as abstract of a theory. You know, you don't have to lay on the couch, you know, talking about your mother and connecting insightful things in a lot of ways, although you can gain a great deal of insight through cognitive behavioral therapy. But I think it's a little bit more easy to package and sell in a lot of ways. So a lot of other people are coming out with their forms of cognitive theory or things about that. And, you know, I know that your book, The Cognitive Rampage, is also, you know, taken upon that and used as philosophies and been able to create a book to help a lot of people.
Yeah.
So I think...
Yeah, we're integrated. It's cognitive to start, but it's behavioral, biological, environmental.
And I know, you know, one thing that you probably don't talk enough about is that you have forms as well that people can complete and... I believe they're online, correct?
Yeah, there's an inventory to run through and a couple applications for... It was my take. Our rational self-analysis is just my take on kind of a
right.
Reframing breakdown.
And I think, you know, one of the things how I use cognitive behavioral therapy is I don't use it in any form of a manual, a treatment, although I may give people readings and things, but I sometimes teach cognitive behavioral therapy as a treatment, more so to educate people about their own thoughts and feelings. And that's traditionally I do sometime within the 2 to 4 sessions in, is that I basically educate people on thoughts and feelings, which, you know, I think you and me have talked before, possibly in private, that they should be teaching cognitive things and feeling things in high school to kids.
Yeah.
Learning about their own brain, learning that there's a difference between thoughts and feelings, how they're connected, that thoughts precede feelings, gaining more insight to it, because I think it's tools that you need to know. We all think and feel, but when we act, you know, very few people actually know the differences between the two. And how they are connected and how they maintain behaviors and where they come from. You know, why do we think what we think? Most of our thoughts are all random, but they come from somewhere. And it kind of goes back into some of that neuroscience that we talked about earlier, is where they come from.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do believe. I mean, we're busy teaching them things that, you know, I don't use a lot of shit from high school or these things, but something that would have helped me greatly is if somebody could explain to me that, you know, what you feel is coming from what you think. Mm-hmm. It's based on what you believe based on what you've experienced.
I'm sure. How many of us act on feelings?
Shit.
You know, a great portion of people act on feelings, and I think when we act on feelings, we're bound to have some behavioral issues or relationship issues or...
I've literally tried to stop using the word feeling. I'm serious, I try to talk myself different. I'm trying to really get rid of that dialogue, because when I find myself going, you know, I just feel like, when I really hear myself, my own device is going to know you had a thought that's creating how you think you should feel. So I'm like, you know what, I'm going to switch my fucking dialogue to be right. So from now on, I kind of go like,
right.
You know, I think that motherfucker wants to be, you know what I mean? Instead of, I feel like.
That's always an interesting thing, that sometimes I'll ask somebody how they feel and they tell me how they think. And then I'll ask them again after you know, how do you feel? And then they'll ask, tell me what they think. And then other people ask them what they think about something, and they'll tell me how they feel. So I think, you know, and it's an interesting little thing. And I always point it out to them, you know, and kind of direct where they need to go with things. But it's interesting that, you know, we think and feel differently, and we mistake the two a lot of the time.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to some of the treatment stuff that you use to walk in to help people with depression. But I do want to answer a question. I get what you're trying to ask is... she's asking if basically bipolar, she put contagious in quotes, but I think there's just a cultural barrier.
Mm-hmm.
I think what she's saying, a family pattern. Is there a genetic implication that's been proven by science that bipolar is some sort of passed down genetic mental mm-hmm. disorder?
Yes. Bipolar disorder is one of the most genetically correlated disorders out there.
And how do they connect that? How do they say that this is the gene that puts off bipolar? So you, mm-hmm. I mean, are we talking severe cases?
Well, what we're talking about is the diagnosis, and there is a lot of research done through, you know, historical things of seeing, you know, genograms, things like that. And that's what they do is, okay, your mother had the diagnosis, your grandmother had the diagnosis. You know, that means you, there's a possibility or a higher likelihood. Does it mean that you will? No. But it does mean that the likelihood is higher. And when it comes to bipolar disorder, that is something that I'd ask for specifically, is has there ever been anybody in your family diagnosed with bipolar disorder? And
that's as close to the medical side that I see, as to where, you know, things become predispositions. And
right.
But again, we go back to the epigenetic influence that would then thus bring out this predisposition. So if we can create the environmental influence and shape it, whether it's
sure.
internally in our head or environmentally, physically, we can either maybe even combat what's been exposed or never reveal that predisposition.
Right, and I think, you know, it's, for one, bipolar disorder has higher prevalence rates in women.
No shit.
So, yeah, it has.
I knew it. Fellas, now you know why dating is a fucking issue. No, I'm just kidding.
You know, in defense of women out there, you know, to save myself.
Women seem pretty
fucked.
They could
be misdiagnosed as well, so.
They're lean toward most to be diagnosed with depression. They're mostly affected with bipolar. Like, fucking.
I think there's a study here.
No wonder they're fucking marching. I'd be fucking marching too for a bunch of shit.
Teen girls have an increase of 11%, I believe. has risen. So teen girls specifically have higher rates of depression. But when it comes to things like that, if you are a child with a predisposition to have bipolar because your mother or father has bipolar disorder and you're raised in a household of bipolar disorder, that could be enough environmental factor. Well,
that's violence, that's promiscuity, that's drug use, that's
impulsivity, instability. Yeah. So that in of itself could be the stress needed in order to trigger some of that.
And a trauma, one traumatic event can spark that too, right?
Traditionally with women, they do have their first manic episode, and not just women, men as well, but it tends to be, in the early 20s age, anywhere between 18 to kind of 23 age is when they typically first have that manic episode. That's kind of what the research shows, but I tell you what, on a side note, my experience is, it may not be diagnosed until a little bit later on, but traditionally you can kind of tell something in a child, that...
The severity level.
You ask their parents and they say, they were a really, really difficult child, or they were diagnosed with this as it, or there was just some sort of temperamental thing that was off as a child. So it's not like this was a perfect child, there was no issues, and then one day they woke up at the age of 22 and they're manic.
I don't think that perfect child exists, right?
Oh, no.
Right. Because now, especially.
Now
that we all fit inside the DSM-5 some level.
No, there's no such, you don't want to be normal. There's something very off and wrong with being normal, so.
And that is why you're the backcountry doctor, man. So we were talking about some of the tactics that, you teach. I love the teaching idea, the idea of educating somebody. Look, here's what we know about this or that. I think that really brings down that red line anxiety that I think a lot of people learn, even that the denial that I don't have a diagnosis, learning what that's more about. So what's more, how have you twisted the CBT? What do you do? How do you apply it? You started to go there, and I totally scrolled this off.
There's the manual-based things, which are really basically self-help things that they can take and do on their own. I give them a little bit of that, just enough to kind of keep it simple and educate themselves, and something that's doable that they can do at work or school or wherever they're at. I don't recommend, large books or workbooks, or say, okay, I don't care what's going on in your life today, we're going to do page 13 here, or I'm going to teach you, I basically get it done pretty quickly in a first session, just a snapshot education about thoughts and feelings. But really what I focus on is the belief system, as you do in your book, is that there's a reason why we think the way we do it. It's ingrained in our belief system. And our belief system, I've talked about before in previous podcasts, it is centered around anything that's ever happened to you in your life. We've basically been a sponge that have sucked up our experiences, our history, things from our family, things from our culture, things from our belief system, education. Basically, we're constantly taking in new information, and that's altering, changing our thought process. So if you really want to make the true change, you can kind of, I've told you before, I'm not a big proponent of positive thinking. I'm a proponent of realistic thinking. And I think when you take it and you can make some realistic thoughts, but then start understanding why you think the way you do and reprogramming yourself, then it changes the thought process completely. And like you said, you rampage the belief system, you destroy, you blow up those beliefs, and you reformulate more accurate beliefs, because we do have accurate beliefs that go on in our mind, or what we think is, accurate based off of our own individual and cultural experiences, but we have many, many distorted beliefs that we act on in relationships, in work, in school, and in our daily lives. That negatively impacts us, and we don't even realize it.
Yeah, well, it's first the acceptance of whatever we experienced is the truth that we created. So most people, as I've been through that traumatic event, you can't tell me it fucking wasn't. I mean, in the clinic, I'm trying to be like, I get it. That's a dark shit you went through. Okay, now what do we do, right? So it's like, do we keep saying, here's the story, here's the trauma, here's what happened? Do we stay there, or do we say, because of that, I then move to this level?
Well, I think there's several different ways of doing that. Yeah, there are people out there who kind of you know, go through EMDR, which is, you know, the eye.
Dude, I hear so much. All my years, everybody's like, I'm a big fan. I was a patient. Didn't fucking work for me, man. I was a young, crazy kid, and all I'm sitting there is I'm watching this green light go back and forth while this dude's talking to me, and I'm like... Yeah.
Or one of the things they do is, you know, the light or
They had this black bar like this, and they had this green light that ran back and forth,
mm-hmm.
and he would then tilt the bar at this degree and then run it this way, and I'm going like, all right, man, I've done a lot of psychedelics in my history. And so staring at some light do some crazy shit while you're talking to me about some of the nastiest shit I've ever done or seen in my life, I'm like, been here.
Well, I think, you know, the theory behind it makes a little bit of sense because at the time of the trauma, it is ingrained through your eye system, you know, and there is a level of rapid eye movement similar to that of sleep where it's kind of imprinted in your thoughts. So
yeah, that's the connection.
It makes sense, but... You know, it's hard to do the research on that because...
Some people love it, dude. Some people, I've heard it.
Some people love it, but I think...
I would tell you the majority loved it. I rarely met somebody that was like, it sucked.
Well, here's the thing is, does the relief come from the actual EMDR rapid eye movement, or does it come from the being desensitized from the catharsis of talking about the trauma, talking about it over, working through it, talking, you know? Because I think... that works as well, you know, to continually work through the trauma through talk. And of course, as you know, that you talk about it and then you watch a little light a lot of times and then you talk about it and you watch a little light.
And go to your safe place. Yeah. It gets a little too rough.
So what is it? Is it the actual catharsis from talking to another human being and getting it off and processing it in a way that desensitizes yourself so when you think about it, it doesn't cause you as much anxiety? Or is it the eye movement that's changing your imprinted experience in your mind?
Yeah, what, revisiting the subconscious, freeing the subconscious right. that you're not, because you're not getting into REM sleep at night. Look, either way, if it works.
Exactly.
Where the fuck else, man? What else we got on these notes, brother?
I don't know, you know,
You did. I'll bring that shit up. You know
okay.
what? I'll bring that shit up. I'm going to open a whole can of worms on this one.
All right.
But, yeah, so I'm going to say, lean off camera, everybody. Hello. So do we have free will?
I'm glad you asked that question. You knew I had notes and wanted to talk about it.
I love how you nonchalantly go in like we're sitting on a daytime talk show. Oh, I love that you asked that question, Adam.
Just so happens that, oh, here it is.
Oh, man, it's because I know where your mind goes, brother, and I have yet to let you text or talk to me about this, so,
all right. Well, you know, the thing about free will is we've talked a lot about the brain and neuroscience and the parts of the brain in which this happens. So what it brings us to is there an existence of free will? If our brain is pre-programmed and, you know, there's always, our brain is driving our thoughts. Our brain is driving a lot of this stuff. Then how much of this...
Something else driving this brain.
Then how much of it is real? You know, I think there's a lot of proponents of free will out there. And I know, you know, one of the most exciting people that I enjoy watching, and I suggest other people to kind of, you know, after we discuss this, look up Sam Harris, the delusion of free will.
Oh, and, Jesus, man. You bringing up that big name on it.
And schooled your boy Joe Rogan there.
Sam has got... Oh, my gosh. That's one dude I'm like, all right, even if my argument wins, it's not going to sound like it does. He's going to make you sound dumb even if you win.
No.
If he ever switched teams and went and argued for the flat earth people, us round earth people are in trouble. That's how good that motherfucker can talk. His cognitive brain base is ridiculous.
If you ever get a chance, watch Sam Harris and Daniel Denton, who's a determinist, saying that everything is kind of predetermined.
Yeah, he's a beast, too. Him and somebody else were just on Rogan, man. But actually, there was an episode of Sam Harris's podcast that I suggested every parent play for their kid.
Mm-hmm.
It was a short 15-minute. It was one of those first ones. It was something about drugs, the meaning of life, or something. I may be crossing over the Tim Ferriss episode. But it was something. But it's definitely a Sam Harris episode, what I'm talking about. But it was it's something to at least ponder and question. So
oh, yeah.
I interrupted you.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, you're welcome to. But here's the thing is, you know, if free will exists, I know everybody wants to have this dream of free will. And, you know, free will is basically it's subjective. You know, the entire feeling of freedom is a subjective experience, which then leads you to the question, does it even exist? and one of the most interesting research, since this is kind of a research program, is this experiment that they did in which they set up buttons and they hooked people up to a whole bunch of brain monitors that measured activity and experience and you know, all sorts of things. And they said it was kind of a timing experience where as soon as they made a decision, they were to push a button as soon as they recognized that they made the decision before they answer and whatnot. And what they found was that about 5 seconds before the people knew that they were going to make the decision, the brain activity and the brain had already made the decision before it crossed over into conscious awareness.
Bam.
So then that makes, you know, even the concept of free will, when you think you do something or you think you're doing something out of free will and based off of your own decisions, it may actually be your brain that's decided 5 seconds before you realize that you wanted to decide something. that is some,
I picked the wrong time to like this shit.
That is some very exciting things because then it, you know, one thing we know is we can't control our thoughts. And I think people get the mistake that they can control their thoughts to it. Now, you can change your thoughts. You can have a negative thought and then push it out. You can meditate through thoughts, or you know, I know where you're at in meditation right now. But
don't get me started.
I won't get you started.
Well, you kind of back me up already, though, because if you try to meditate and be one and quiet your mind, we all know you're sitting there going,
"Well,
don't think of that. Just chant this."
Where do thoughts come from?
Right.
You can't control whether you think of something or not because it's random. It pops in.
I have a deep theory on that. We're not going to get into that. Keep educating me, man.
Well, they are random. You know, I mean, and Sam Harris gives an example of, you know, talking about cooking owls and eating them. And the crowd starts laughing. He says, see, that was random. You didn't know that I was going to say that.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, your brain doesn't know what's about to pop into your head so until it's popped in there. So the brain is operating on an unconscious level. We're going back to Freud, if you want to go in that. But it's operating at an unconscious level, possibly making decisions and guiding your behavior, almost like you're a puppet.
Yeah.
You are a puppet to your own neurological cognitive process.
Perception.
So therefore, you know, Sam Harris questions the ability for free will to even exist because of evidence like that.
Until we can prove where thoughts come from,
mm-hmm.
we are left to just think that we are moved by the thoughts we think we create,
mm-hmm.
but randomly appear.
Right.
And now it's almost like we know it's coming out of the gate, so we can get a handle on the thought as it comes out the gate and be like, all right, there it is, not that one.
Exactly.
Here it is, not that one.
Here's the thing, we're not responsible for our own thoughts. And that's something that Sam Harris says. We're not responsible for our own thoughts, but we are responsible for our feelings. Because if you look at the premise of cognitive behavioral therapy or theory in general, it's the thought that triggers the feeling. So the thought can be triggered for any number of reasons. The brain just throws it out there.
Yeah.
Once we have the thought, that's where our self can come in and say, okay, I have the awareness of this is what I'm thinking right now, and therefore I can control my feeling. But for people out there, traditionally, they don't have that awareness.
The people that watch Bob disappear from the campfire that are walking around on those feelings going like, the bush is... You have to go all the way back to the podcast, people, in the beginning.
Well, I think the other thing is that people get too attached to thoughts as if their thought is their soul.
It's truth.
It's them.
It's truth.
You know, and thoughts are nothing more than just thoughts. They're like passing weather, just kind of going over. They come and go. We're not responsible for them. But when we get attached to a thought or a thought process, that's when we become upset about it a lot of the time.
Responsible for it.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so responsible for it, yeah.
Yeah, but I think you, yeah, but once we become responsible for it at that point, you know, that's where the awareness comes in to change it. But a lot of people, you know, we're all, you know, everybody has sometimes disturbing thoughts or weird thoughts or strange things. It's when they get attached to them that it becomes upsetting to them.
All right, so we're going to go back. So I'm going to take the novice devil's advocate here. And here's free will.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I decided to put that there and not drink it and move that there. I had free will to do that.
When did you decide to do that?
Right now, like I just decided to move it back there.
Okay.
All right. Is that free will?
Well, according to this, no.
All right.
Because your brain had made up that decision to do that.
And it probably did, because I was thinking about what to do to try to prove to you that I could do it. So somewhere along the line, possibly I thought about the most basic thing to do and tried to respond to it as fast mm-hmm. as we can. But truthfully, our behavior cannot respond as fast as our thoughts are coming out.
Right. Well, I think a good example of how our brain works unconsciously is...
But it feels so good to think I have free will, Dr. Parker Mott.
Of course, it's subjective. It's subjective. Everybody, you know, we can go through this, you know, world feeling like we really are free when, you know, there's different levels of freedom. There's social freedom, political freedom, freedom to think, and freedom related to thought. And I think, you know, we like to think that our thoughts are ours. We like to think that we are initiating thought, and that just doesn't seem to be the case in a lot of ways.
Let's back out of that now. I'm still with you. So, fuck. So, we still, even myself, man. I mean, I even get it. I wrote the whole book on the shit.
Right.
But even that idea of facing the cognitive dissonance for so many has got to be too big, because the idea almost of even thinking we don't have free will in the choices we make,
mm-hmm.
you know, seems to be, it would be too much. I have to, no, I control my destiny. How do we work that in with the external and internal locus of control?
You control your thought after it becomes aware to you.
Thank you.
That's what's missing in a lot of people's lives is the awareness. And that's what, you know, things like, you know, mindfulness preaches, Buddhism, all sorts of, you know, even cognitive behavioral therapy and your therapy is the awareness that of the thought process in order to change it. The awareness of the thoughts when they occur. But what happens prior to the thoughts, we have no control over, because that's the process of the unconscious mind.
That's the fucking amazing part of it. That's why I think I get so jumpy about prescription drugs, is because they're dabbling with that wizardry that we don't know anything about that's happening here. And we're throwing all kinds of...
Well, I think a good example is hunger. You know, you think of hunger. When do you recognize you're hungry?
Right now.
Right? You recognize you're hungry when you have a feeling, right? But before that, your brain had to initiate to recognize something within the body to send the alert that there was hunger. And you don't have the thought about hunger until you notice it.
Who are you asking, right, in your head when you're like,
exactly.
Am I hungry? Who the fuck are we talking to? You know what I mean?
Right.
I know I do that, where I'm like, I should eat. Am I hungry? Who the fuck am I?
Are we hungry?
Wait, maybe I'm telling
How
myself.
How are we doing here?
I may be telling myself right now, man. All right, am I the only person? No?
You are not responsible for your thoughts.
Well, I keep getting that the fetus froze, but I want to pull it back. It says it's working, people. If it's still live, somebody let me know. I can cut this out of the podcast stuff. But
they stopped listening a long time ago.
Yeah, they walked away. It's been a minute. I can't freeze it. I can freeze it and go back live again and try round two, but I want to be able to have like the whole thing on there. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really a question we never answer, right? I can already hear the mechanical people yelling at us going, it's a question you'll never fucking answer anyway. Why entertain it? Be mechanistic. We know, I mean, at least we can be mechanistic. That's why I think I love the cognitive approach so much. It was the closest mechanistic approach to an abstract art, like psychology,
mm-hmm.
that's slowly beginning to lean toward a science now.
Right.
You know, that was an art. For me, cognitive therapy was like, okay, I get that. That's mechanistic. You are aware of what your beliefs are. Being aware of just the process itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Adding to some other level. You know what I mean? That's what brought me into it. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I sat with enough therapists telling me a whole bunch of shit.
Well, you were talking about the mechanism of kind of the cognitive theories, and, you know, that's actually one of the criticisms of cognitive theory is that it's too mechanistic and too manual-based, and it's not artistic abstract enough in some ways, because I think...
Yeah, Freud brought some serious abstract shit to the table, which I love the dude, got a lot of respect. He announced it back when people thought it was demons, and he said, it's because you wanted to sleep with your mother. I mean, that takes some fucking cojones to say that shit, right? I mean, you got to really come out and people are like, he's not a scene. Maybe he means something, right? So, I mean, moving from there, for me, that's why I said why cognitive, the approach pulled me. It was more mechanistic. I could easily see where it came from.
It's a little more structured. I think people look for structure in their life, and it does meet that. And I think that's a good thing because it allows people to understand easily. It fits people's their own schema or their own idea of what life is and how it can fit in, and it's educating. So I think there's a great benefit to the cognitive work. I just use it more as intervention a lot of times on top of the other things. So I don't get pigeonholed into one form of therapy, and I think that's part of the problem with cognitive behavioral is it's so easy to do research on because of the structure that so much research has been done and manuals been put out. That, you know, a trained monkey can pick one up and be a therapist.
Yeah.
So I think
there's actual research on that.
I think there is.
I do. They did research on, it was actually kids, sorry for the correlation of monkey and kids, but they actually did a map or a study with kids and applying cognitive behavioral therapy. Uh-huh. I was trying to remember, Disney ended up doing some movie off of it.
Inside Out.
Yeah.
They had a number of psychologists working on that. That was a very good movie. Not completely accurate about thoughts and feelings, but I think it embraced the role of accepting, you know, negative feelings with positive as just an experience that we need both to be whole.
Imagine that we told our kids the fucking truth the minute they could listen and talk. They go, listen, you're going to have thoughts that you can't control. Now, entertain those thoughts and decide what to do with those thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And we can process those, whether they're rational, whether they're real, before you allow them to fully take place and enjoy the feeling.
Exactly.
So we run from feelings many times and we try to create them. But imagine if you told a kid, honestly, instead of like, hey, mom and dad got our shit together, so get your shit together.
Yeah.
And the truth is like, look, they're as neurotic and as scared as your ass is, you know, in the other room. But if we told our kids that from the beginning, entertain the thoughts. What you do with them from there, you know, really decides really that your behavior, that how you'll be judged, really.
The thoughts are just thoughts, you know, and we have to look at them like a sixth sense, you know, touch, taste, smell. Thought is just kind of a sense. We can't put too much emphasis on thought.
Yeah, I put it on the thought part as, in the book I talk about it being a red flag.
Mm-hmm.
To where if there's a certain feeling that you're used to having, entertain the thought that's creating that feeling. That's a red flag running up, kind of saying, all right, start here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, work down from that feeling and ask the why questions. Really try to cultivate that belief, right? That feeling, what do I believe now? Why is this upsetting me? Or why do I believe that's upsetting me?
Right.
What am I creating in my own mind?
Yeah. And it's usually a thought distortion that, you know, what you're creating is something that's bad, and you believe that it's bad, and therefore you're reacting and having a feeling as if that were to happen, it's bad. You know, worst case scenario is one of them. Thinking about worst case scenario is, what if this happens? You know, the what if leads to, and we end up having a feeling as if it's going to happen.
Yeah, I love that when somebody walks in and, oh, I just have a feeling. I got a feeling about this one. I'm like, oh my God. Really? Pause for a moment.
Yeah.
Explain that feeling to me without using any thought you had.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You're like, oh, okay. So explain to me that. I don't know.
You know, one of the things I like to do.
I love it. It's just something inside. Yeah. It's just something inside.
Inside.
Yeah, that thought inside that you
I just
keep.
Know.
Yeah, I just know. Now, look, I'm not saying one day we won't morph into some X-Men, read your mind shit, manifestation, the secret, whatever, make it happen. But at this point,
yeah.
I love my biggest argument to that bullshit, the secret, is going, your argument is that everyone that hasn't achieved their goal just hasn't believed in it enough.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, and people bought onto that shit. And I was like, really? He's slapping you all in the face by telling you that the reason you haven't made it because you haven't truly believed it enough. You know how many motherfuckers have tried their dream for so long going,
oh, no.
I ain't got shit left, and they read The Secret, and The Secret's like, you just ain't believed hard enough.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, write it down, hang it up. There you go.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? For me, I was like, what the fuck?
You know, so nothing to knock self-help seminars, because, you know, there are a number of people who do get a lot out of it, or, you know, to tell you the truth, a lot of the things are, you know, obviously there's self-help gurus out there who've taken work from you. You know, so I think there's something to be said for some of it, but, you know, the truth of the matter is the room is filled with people who are looking for answers and hope, and I think that's what they sell them a lot of ways.
Thank you for making me nicer. And that's the truth, because beneath that hard surface I'm putting on the top is really that I believe the field should be wide open. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that there should be these only scientific studies that were allowed. I'm saying, look, if we're gonna open the opiate floodgates, mm-hmm. well, fuck. I mean, if we're running green lights on eyes, if we're opening this up, well, right. Shit, open up the whole fucking gate, man, and try every fucking thing.
Right. I think, you know, you do tend to be critical about certain things on this show, which I think you need to do. I think we all need to be critical. We all have to critique ourselves. We all have to critique our methods. We all have to critique everything in order to make advancements. Because if we went through questioning nothing, we would believe everything.
Yeah.
And I don't think we need to do that as well. We do need to question medicine. We need to question therapy. We need to question, you know, even when research points to these things being helpful, we need to not be satisfied with that, but dig deeper to find how to make things better, make things work better, make things more safe. So I think it's the criticism and things like that that keep, you know, the mind open.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, I'll lay it on myself, is that when I do get so angry and I'm built up and the thought that I keep creating, you know, that hurt and fear is what's really the in-depth of all anger. So if I'm ranting on a rampage about this diagnosis, this DSM, the truth is, people, is I'm hurt and I'm afraid.
Yeah.
And that's the truth. I'm hurt that this is all we offer. I'm hurt that, and so it looks like I'm pointing out, you know, at 12 mm-hmm. steps, etc. I'm like, it helps some people. There's more. There's so much more.
There is.
And so I get hurt that, like, how dare we hold this back and so much mm-hmm. legislation only to be able to control where the money gets funneled to is the only mm-hmm. reason, than trying to have an insurance process to be able to match the billing. When, as practitioners, we all know, we're like, yeah, fill it out the way they say we have to, but do what you got to do. Work between this behavioral. Come at this. Use them all. It's integrative, right? Come at that. And that's the truth, man. Right. And so for me, I have a fear because mm-hmm. I'm an avid chess player in my head and my mind in real life. And so when I see a small move like that, I can't help but back up and look at the whole board and go, fuck, are we headed with therapy?
Right.
You know what I mean? If we're rolling the dice with dope like we do, mm-hmm. you know, and a brain that we know little about, that we do know probably controls most of motherfucking all of it.
Pretty much.
Right? And it's amazing, man. But there's, I don't know, for me, that hurt and fear leads to an anger. You know, that anger,
sure.
because I make assumptions that will never, they will, a rational belief. Do you hear it come out? That will never make it.
Yeah.
So hence why I would get angry, why I go off sometimes, is I fixate on that thought and that lack of hope. You know, because my 17-year-old makes me think like that shit now, man.
I know.
I used to not give a fuck. I don't give a shit. Live today, die tomorrow, man. I'll make you famous. You know what I mean?
I think you can't lose hope. I think if you lose hope, that takes away from the people out there who need to keep moving forward. And we do need to keep moving forward, and we need to be positive moving forward. But the things we have right now, they're not perfect. They're flawed, but they're the best we have.
Damn right.
You know, and I think we're going to make further progress on it. We're going to come out with better research, better methods, better knowledge of the brain, better knowledge of why we feel the way we feel, where thoughts come from, all of that stuff. It's going to happen. It's just going to have to come in time. And, you know, not to harp on it too much because we've talked about it, but we need to educate people.
Yeah.
We need to educate people on mental health. We need to talk about studies, you know, regarding the brain.
Let's go there.
Yeah.
Let's actually get to all that fucking study and all this shit you brought. I'm cutting you off because
you know, to tell you the truth, we got through a lot of the brain stuff. I mean, it's, you know, I'd say go online and, you know, join something like the American Psychological Association or Neuroscience or magazines or things like that, because they're going to read so many...
questions, sir.
Oh, okay. Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. Somebody's listening.
I think it's about me. No, I'm kidding. You'll get it why I said that. But okay. It's a practitioner inside joke, right? Question from Sebastian. The theory of different personality types and its role in diagnosis, if there is any.
The theory of personality types, I assume he probably means through like different theories, because every theory has a basically an explanation of personality, how personality develops and how problems develop. You know, whether it's psychoanalysis or cognitive behavioral therapy or anything like that, it explains why we feel, think, or feel like we do, how we develop a personality type, what personality types there are, and how problems arise in personality types. The arisal of, you know, kind of psychopathology, which is kind of the study of problems in mental health, it's more relegated, it seems separate from the DSM. You know, I don't think that, you know, the DSM doesn't get into things like, you know, according to Freud, XYZ, this is why you feel the way you feel. Those are all things that come about through treatment and therapies. And there's different therapies that hypothesize how problematic behaviors in mental health manifest itself. Object relations suggests that, you know, we develop a personality type based on our very first interactions with objects. Objects meaning people, mainly our parents. So do we develop how we relate to other objects, people, through a certain way, and then we also develop problems based off of that. The DSM and diagnosis is normally completely separate from personality theory. And I think that is, for one, DSM is more symptom-based, more research-based, trying to be a little bit more medical, where things like personality types are a little more subjective.
It's not scientific. They're going based off traits. And again, self-report of whatever survey or personality type is, you know, that's the issue, right? In mental health is the self-report, the patient self-report is all you have to go on, you know, which is laid up in some deeply subjective notion.
Right.
You know, it's hard. That's why, again, we're all the way back to the neuroscience of why, you know, we got to maybe go deeper down that road, because all we have is a patient to say, yeah, I don't sleep good. Yeah, I've been sad.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not doing that anymore.
Right.
We're going to take this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's, you know, we have.
I think one of the things they do is they do try and connect the dots between, you know, personality and diagnosis, psychopathology. And they do that by taking the diagnosis and doing research backwards about how they got to that diagnosis. For example, you know, personality types, you know, there's the type A personality. They're ones who... They are ones who do tend to have more problems overall due to, you know, the little bit more aggression.
They die earlier, too.
Yeah. There's a number of different health issues related to it. So I think what they do is they take personality styles or types and do research on those to determine patterns of people who have that, and then that gets to the development of how those, you know, so it's kind of working backwards in some ways from a diagnosis.
Yeah, and another follow-up question from Sebastian is, you know, I mean, the discussion of the multicultural influence of psychology, and specific, he's asking toward diagnosis.
Right.
You know, I've been out of the school and in the practice of it, so with more and more influence coming from multiple cultures involved in psychology, where does that really influence the creation of the DSM, or at least, you know, assigning a diagnosis?
Well, I think there's still a lot of problems with diversity within the DSM. They try and address cultural
things. Like the fucking SAT, right?
Right. They try and address cultural aspects. They don't probably do the best job, but I think that's why the DSM allows for flexibility, is because there's some behaviors within a cultural context which is considered normal, and, you know, should not be looked at as problems or psychopathology. You know, they're normal within the context of that culture, which then excludes them from a diagnosis of in the DSM.
Yeah, and again, we're back to talking about how quick a assessment is these days, whether it's entrance into a dual diagnosis facility or it's the labeling of a severe diagnosis.
Yeah.
You know, and with such a cultural mix now, for one meeting to apply any kind of diagnosis is seeming more and more unethical.
Yeah, and I think the quick diagnosis, obviously, we could have an entire show on insurance and things like that.
That's another thing. But I talk shit. Is it true that in order to be admitted to a clinical hospital, one must have a diagnosis before admission?
Oh, there's a number of different things you have to meet criteria for, especially, I think it's called ASAMS. I think that's what the state of Florida requires to meet necessity to be paid through the state or something like that. For the facility to get paid, if it's a government facility, they have to meet criteria and have treatment plans, all sorts of paperwork in order to qualify. But it's a huge process of paperwork and you do need a dual diagnosis in order to, for one, get paid, but two, get admitted. So, you know, when you're sitting in front of somebody who you know has a problem, but they might not fit the perfect criteria, that's where the DSM allows the flexibility to say, okay, you know, we can, you know, it can still fit, even though it doesn't meet criteria. This person obviously has some issues. You know, you don't want to send somebody back out on the street who has an issue and needs help.
Right.
You just have to be able to explain it very well to where insurances or government, you know, agrees.
Yeah, I'm going to come to the defense of a lot of counselors and practitioners that have to walk that line. Because I've been there. I've been in that chair to where I'm looking at somebody that really, really needs the fucking help.
Oh, yeah.
And they're either out of days or one more diagnosis or not. Mm-hmm. Right. It's where it's so like, fuck, I can't put that diagnosis, but it's the only way insurance will let them stay. I damn sure I'm not discharging them.
Right.
You know, I've been there. And, mm-hmm. I mean, talk about that hot seat, if you will, that how many therapists and psychologists in clinic, private practice, really face, mm-hmm. you know, of how do I give someone treatment without labeling them?
Yeah, and I don't think anybody in the field wants to label people. I mean, our whole field is based off of trying to be accepting and non-judgmental. You know, so I think the idea that we're judging and labeling people is, you know, it's misconceived. I think it comes from an area of fear, which I think is, you know, it's valid in terms of being afraid to be labeled by something.
Yeah.
But the people who are doing the diagnosis don't want to label you. They don't want to judge you. You know, they want to...
Hopefully.
You know, and it is
keep the lights on, though.
Yeah, I don't think there'd probably even be much in terms of a diagnosis anymore.
I think they should just get paid. I think it should just... Our lights on. I happen to be a licensed counselor. Here's how much it costs, but you're covered. You don't have to prove the shit. Just come.
Sure, you can do that if you pay out of pocket.
Right, if you got a lot of fucking cash, right?
If you got the money, you can do that.
God, I don't care. I mean, I'm not even talking medical health, okay? That's not my expertise. I just mean from a mental health standpoint, it should be like you're licensed in your field and mine. We throw up the sign.
Mm-hmm.
We're taking care of you on a state level, local level, fed, whatever, mixed level somehow, which it sort of is with the Medicare. But fuck the insurance companies. You should just come in, we'll do the paperwork after we make sure you don't want to fucking kill yourself,
right.
You know, or get off of the fucking drugs, or maybe we save, you know, a feeling, or save a job or something, you know?
Well, it is difficult, because people do have to get paid in order to stay in business.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there is a line there. I think, for the most part, you know, there are counselors who are put in difficult positions like that, but obviously if you get to a point where, you know, you have to go into a drug facility or a crisis unit, you're going to meet a diagnosis for something that qualifies you. You know, you're not just in there.
That's why I don't go to them. Yeah. As long as you don't go to them, they can't give you the diagnosis for fucking something, right? Because we all meet it, according to every other drug commercial you see go by. There's actually another question, man. Actually, two parts. Is talking about the risk of being misdiagnosed at first and then trying to recover from a misdiagnosis, mm-hmm. And applying a different treatment.
Yeah, I find that is something that happens more in terms of psychiatry. You know, I sit with a person long enough to really get to know them, where by the time a diagnosis is made, you're pretty sure that the diagnosis is correct.
All right, what's my diagnosis?
Crazy, man.
Yeah. All right.
They haven't put a diagnosis in the DSM for you yet.
No.
Yeah. One of a kind, man. We need to do research on you.
Yeah. Well, that's why I invite you. I do my therapy public online. Everyone, you see how I work my shit up?
I do.
All right. It's how I get the best without paying shit. Right? I just got to promote his shit.
Right.
Right?
But yeah, going back to that, I think that is something that is scary because they make a diagnosis and they do prescribe something like psychotropic medications, things like, Lamictal, Abilify, even antidepressants, antipsychotics, things like that. So you don't want to make a misdiagnosis there. And I think the insurance companies, greed, having to pay for malpractice insurance, there's a whole variety of things why that diagnosis has to be named quickly and sometimes not accurately. And it's unfortunate because sometimes people who go to a psychiatrist do get misdiagnosed and put on medication which is not correct. And I see it on a regular basis, and I think that's why your psychiatrist, maybe going to therapy first is the best tool, because you can go to therapy, get a good diagnosis and feel for what's going on, work on it, and then go to a psychiatrist if you still need to, and have a psychologist consulting with a psychiatrist, talking about how they're working, what they're seeing, what's really going on, versus somebody going in there and saying, yeah, I'm moody. Seems like I have some energy a lot. Yeah, I do stay up pretty late and traveling. Okay, you're bipolar.
Yeah.
Where you can talk with a psychiatrist will talk or communicate with a psychologist, which you hope they will, because sometimes we don't exactly correlate and consult the way that needs to happen. The ones that I work with, we work very well together in terms of consulting, but you want to have a team there. You want to have an accurate diagnosis. You do want to do your own research. I say it time and time again about, taking your own medical health into your own hands. You need to do that with your own mental health. Do the research. Don't do WebMed and, stuff like that, because you will. You can get a splinter and you believe that you've got 6 months to live. And it's the same way with mental health. There's a student syndrome that, when we were learning the DSM, the first time you went through it, you thought you were schizophrenic, bipolar, depressed, and had a personality disorder from every cluster.
It's true.
So you feel like, do your own research, educate yourself, take what the blogs say for a grain of salt, because you're going to pick and choose some good things out of there. You're going to have people on the blogs writing about medications or therapy that aren't satisfied or suffering from mental illness as well. But you just have to take a wide variety of information. First and foremost, if you do choose medication, find a doctor that you feel comfortable with. If you do not feel comfortable with your doctor, if they don't spend enough time with you, if they don't listen to you, find a new one.
Yeah, if he won't give you his direct cell phone number, try a different doctor.
There you go.
Just don't get all groundhog day, y'all. You know what I mean? Where you're just showing up all the time. What about Bob?
Yeah.
Actually, there was a question that popped up when you were talking, and I know I've actually got emails about from a few people, is if, when you do see a psychiatrist, psychologist, if a mental health diagnosis is laid down, a lot of people think somehow through their insurance it's linked to their job finding out, and somehow this is going on some sort of permanent record.
Right. In terms of confidentiality, everything you discuss with your doctor is confidential.
And this is even if the work benefits are paying for me to see this counselor.
That's the other part. No. When it comes to that, that's not always guaranteed. And I'll explain that. Because you have insurance through your work, don't think that they know your diagnosis or anything like that.
Some people are like, just went all anonymous. They're like, fucking no, they know everything.
Don't sign off yet. What happens is, a claim and diagnosis goes to your insurance company. Confidentiality is between you, your insurance company, and the clinician. The clinician does not disclose your history, what you're doing, things like that. There's usually, a diagnosis is sufficient unless the insurance company audits it, and then they'll go back through your notes. But they don't take, a lot of notes through that. Your insurance company does know the diagnosis, and for the most part, that's pretty much all they know. They don't know intimate parts of your life, and they won't, especially, you know, in terms of progress notes, which they typically don't ever ask for unless there's some form of an audit of the clinician. The only time your job would ever know anything about your mental health is if you signed a consent form for them to know that, or that they are paying as a third party for it directly. Say, you know, things like...
it's like bugging your fucking subconscious, man.
Yeah, Johnny is having anger problems at work. So work contacts you and says, hey, we have somebody with anger problems. We're going to send them to you. And they send them to you, and you have a direct consent
form. So if your work is sending you to somebody, be cautious of what you're signing.
I would say there's no guarantee that your work will know anything, because I've done that before where the work says, hey, did you...
HIPAA doesn't jump in the middle even if your work is third-party payer. HIPAA doesn't...
No, because you sign your consent away your work to know. So not all works do that. You know, there's been plenty of them where the work says, did the person complete the anger management? And I'm like, yep, and that was it.
Yeah.
They didn't know anything about what was discussed. They didn't know about, you know, anything... related. So typically work will never know anything about that. And to tell you the truth, if I had somebody's job want to have anything to do with progress notes or intimate details of treatment, I probably would not disclose that even if I had a consent to do so. Because
Is that a duty to inform the client if their job inquires about trying to get their mental health records?
No, related to...
Well, I know duty to inform is suicide, but it's more or less kind of an ethical line. Not duty to inform, I guess, suicide. But, I mean, is that an ethical line? Because for me, I'm kind of like, I think I'd call my client and be like, hey, by the way, your boss called and asked for your mental health diagnosis and files and reports.
Oh, I would always disclose that to a patient, and I wouldn't feel comfortable for it. And to tell you the truth, if for some reason I did have to release things, normally I say, okay, you know, what I'm going to do is I'll write you up a little treatment summary.
And I still said duty one is suicide. Duty one is knowing that somebody's going to get murdered by somebody else.
Right.
And fuck that up.
That's all right. You've been out of the game for a little while.
Hey, that's why I got you, babe. That's why I bring you in and you update. There's a couple more questions, man.
Sure.
Chris Farnsworth, I was trying to make out it. So can you guys get some advice on the times where you're involved with someone you'd like to introduce to some therapy? I was trying to understand that a little bit more. Did you get that?
Read it again.
I'll try. Can you guys get some advice on the times where you're involved with someone you'd like to introduce to some therapy? I think he's saying, how do I tell my girlfriend she needs therapy?
Yeah.
Oh, man, you're hiding that one there, aren't you, Chris? That's quick. In case she's watching, man, you better delete that shit real quick.
Right.
This is how you tell your wife that she needs therapy. You don't tell your wife that she needs therapy. That's how you do it. Am I right?
You can't get somebody help who doesn't want help. And
see how you say it so much fucking nicer and more clinical?
Try to.
I'm like, don't say shit.
Don't say it.
Don't inference, don't lean toward.
Whether it's drugs, alcohol, depression, bipolar disorder, personality disorder, nobody will get help unless they're ready to get help. And you can force somebody to go in the session. And, you know, I've had it. I've had them sit there and I'm looking at them and I'm like, you don't really want to be here. You know, I know you don't.
You call it out like that, don't you?
Sure, and you have to, you know. You know, you just give the person what you can give them in that session. You know, I think the person has to come up with it on their own, especially if therapy is going to work. They have to start making the dots that, hey, you know, something's not right. Maybe I should go to talk to somebody. You can give hints. You know, you can't say, you know, I'm really worried about you and stuff like that.
Don't you fucking go there.
Let me tell you, it can backfire badly.
Yeah.
It can backfire badly. You know your spouse, family, friends.
You have a better chance of diagnosing yourself. Yeah. That's what I would tell you.
You know, sometimes you do.
If you smelt it, you probably dealt it. So be careful, too. If you're out there going like, hey, I think you got a personality disorder.
Before you tell somebody to go to therapy, you better make sure that, you know, you've checked yourself to make sure you're not the problem first.
Yeah, but see, I can say that because I know I'm the middle crazy problem already.
I think sometimes we have to set an example. If we want somebody, a family member, to go to therapy, maybe we ought to start going to therapy to learn how to better help or cope with that family member.
Yeah.
And then you can say, hey, you know, I'm going to improve myself. I'm going to try and help myself.
Maybe
it sends a message that, you know, change has to start with ourselves. It's not going to hurt to go to therapy. We can all use it.
I like that. I challenge any parent out there that believes their child needs to be in therapy. Because I did learn this, too, as you will confirm it. But I forget the veteran. Oh, what's his name? I got to bring this guy back. Ah, oh, Sam. No, I can see him, man. Anyway, he was a guy I practiced with in Naples.
Oh.
He goes, listen, man, 9 times out of 10, if the parent's bringing you the child, the parent needs therapy. And I was like, oh, man, that's funny. He was fucking right. I'm like, holy shit. Many times I had to be like, this kid's great, man. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with this kid. And I have to then bring, you know, mom or dad mm-hmm. and be like, all right, you're out of your fucking mind.
Yeah.
All right, you're projecting on your kid here. You know, you're pushing that mm-hmm. pushing that diagnosis off that way, man.
I think at times. It also depends on the environment in which you're treating people. Because what I do find is...
Oh, I didn't finish my challenge.
Oh.
Is rather... Sorry, that's my fault. Totally careless. Is rather than as a parent... thinking that something's wrong with your child mm-hmm. or maybe forcing that therapy is go yourself. And I don't mean go together as if you're parenting with them and you're there protecting them. Go solo. Go you as an individual to a therapist, a different one,
mm-hmm.
and then show your child.
Well, see, I would have explained it all if you would have let me finish.
No. You'll do it more elegantly anyway, man. I'm doing like the Price is Right challenge over here. I'm a game show host challenge. Yeah, I'm yelling obscenities.
It's Jerry Springer on one side.
It is. I mean, Parker's the father.
What I was going to say was, I think it depends on the environment in which you're treating, because in private practice, I find a lot of parents who come in encourage therapy because they themselves have been in therapy in the past or currently and feel like it works for them and they want to pass that on to children. So yeah. I find that a lot of times people who are coming into private practice have positive experiences of therapy or have friends or family or spouses who have. So I think that's, you know, conveying your own positive experiences of therapy to other people will help encourage them to seek out their own therapy, whether it's for themselves or their children.
# release the stigma.
Ooh.
Mental health is real. Now, there's another question too from Patricia. Is there a certain age restriction, meaning what's too young to diagnose?
Good question. There's childhood disorders and there's teenage disorders and adulthood disorders. There's certain disorders in adulthood which probably should not be diagnosed in childhood, such as bipolar disorder. I think, you know, the main focus at that age is not diagnosing a child, you know, somebody who's 4, 5, 6 years old as being bipolar as much as treating the behaviors at that age. That's more important than a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. There are childhood diagnoses such as, you know, selective mutism.
I think my daughter goes through that, where she just doesn't talk to me for a couple hours.
I think that's one of those things where you have to look at yourself before you start saying there's a problem with someone else.
I like that thought, though. I entertain that thought to keep the belief.
Maintain the belief.
That's it.
There you go. No, there are childhood disorders. Typically, the childhood disorders focus on things like autism. ADHD as well, but I even believe that there's kind of an age of ADHD where, you know, I don't like diagnosing under the age of really 6 or 7, you know, because I think there's so many different behaviors that can go on that it's more important to find out what's really going on for the child than to label them at that point. And I think the best you can do with a child sometimes is because behaviors vary in children with such, and they can't communicate their feelings. They can't communicate their thoughts, which is what they don't know how. So all we can do is go on objective data. So the best thing to do for children is to do therapy and be a researcher with children versus being quick to diagnose. Now, there are children out there with some very, very severe behavioral disturbances. And they do require medications at a young age. And, you know, your heart goes out to them and the parents because they're going to have a rough life normally. Mm-hmm. And the struggle is just to get them to a point where they can have a resemblance of a normal life. So I think, You know, and in those cases, medication is necessary. But with the typical child, you know, without cognitive testing, like if somebody comes in saying their child has some attention problems and school issues, I send testing material to go to both parents, to the teachers in the school. I do personality tests. I do IQ tests. I do achievement tests for math, for written expression, for reading. So it's a full psychological battery along with some personality things involved in order to come to an accurate diagnosis. And then I provide a number of recommendations based off of that. So I do extensive testing with all the children in which there's questions about things like that. I wouldn't simply just diagnose a child based off of what, you know, the behaviors like that. I think there's got to be a more in-depth investigation about what's going on. Because like you said, you know, I mean, the child isn't going to be able to communicate thoughts and feelings to anybody.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people would say, you know, what's the comparative norm, right? Like, mm-hmm. we're saying the kid is hyperactive. And a lot of people make the comparison, well, school's boring and sucks anyway. The kid, you know, what in your mind is the practitioner that's doing the diagnosis? What are you really measuring that normity to, that mm-hmm. normal sum? What walk through people why? Mm-hmm. Fix it.
I think adults sometimes forget what it's like to be a child. And, you know, we look back as being a child through our own adult eyes now. We don't remember that. Sometimes we were hyper. Sometimes we misbehaved and talked too much in class and daydreamed and, you know, didn't listen to our parents and things like that. So I think there's a level of, you know, it definitely crosses a line when it affects social functioning, school functioning, academic functioning, things like that. And it takes some testing to do. You know, I never make a diagnosis based off of one test alone. I put a lot more emphasis on clinical interviews that I conduct with a teacher, with the parents, sometimes with a child if they're old enough to be able to communicate a little more, which is usually around the age of 10 or 12. But aside from that, you know, the IQ test is a performance-based test of cognitive abilities where if someone has ADHD, oftentimes you're going to see it on there. Also in terms of, you know, learning disabilities like math, reading, and written expression, you see it in that.
Yeah.
I also send, you know, things to the teachers where teachers say, well, you know, we're seeing this behavior there, and the parents saying, no, we're seeing this behavior there. So I look for matchups to see if there's consistency or there's a difference between how the child is at home versus how they are at school. Because a child could run amok at home, and then they go to school and they make good grades and they perform and they listen to the teachers and there's no behavioral problems, which suggests the child doesn't have ADHD, that there's something maybe going on in the family system.
Mm. Well, this is a difficult question. I think a lot of parents should face at least once.
Mm-hmm.
If their child or you know, is on that cusp, right, of this idea of diagnosis, is that parent projection, that how much does the mental health diagnosis allow the parent to then relieve responsibility mm-hmm. of the created environment, mm-hmm. of the expectations that are enforced? You know, I mean, I can see where a parent goes, it must be a mental health issue mm-hmm. because I'm not the wrong parent. The environment is fine, and we have to go now because Johnny has a schedule, okay? So there's 7 things to do tomorrow. But no, it's not me. He just has anxiety.
Well, you know, the children who come to me usually have parents who care. They care enough to call up and find a doctor to get them in. So the parents that I typically work with are good parents. You know, I'm not working in atmospheres with DCF or places like that where the parents are made to come in and they tell, you know, they think their child is fine. These parents are caring enough to recognize or be concerned enough about a child in order to get them help and listen. And make those recommendations and behavioral changes or parenting changes or parenting skills that they need to do. I think in terms of, I find diagnosis a lot of times is very relieving for the parents. That oftentimes they've looked for answers, even with a child. I've seen children break down. I've seen teenagers break down. I've seen parents break down for relief. That now they finally have an answer of what's going on.
Or
now they have a direction.
Or did they just see the Corvette?
Corvette.
Because they're looking for it, right?
You know, I don't see that. I don't see that with the people I work with. Yeah. And I think that's because, you know, like I said, the parents I work with are generally very good parents. And I think there
smart
is
enough
a,
to bring them to you, so yeah.
I think there's a big relief sometimes that comes with that. From time to time, they also break down because now they have a diagnosis and they know, you know, in the back of their mind, they hope that their child didn't have something. But now that they know, there's that fear of what the child's life is going to be like, you know, and in those times I do comfort the parent and I provide a great deal of recommendations because I think that, you know, I provide very long, thorough reports, but at the end of the report, it's good to have a diagnosis, but what really matters is what we're going to do about it. And that's really where I instill hope and say, let's get to work. So, even if they, are sad about the diagnosis, they leave my office knowing exactly what they're going to do and how we're all going to be working together. So there's a great deal of hope.
Yeah, so educate them in the beginning. Let them know what they're facing. Bring the tools and strategies to them. Try to remove that anxiety. I got a more. Just to follow up with the question from Patricia. So verifying that there really is no real age restriction, just more of an analysis until older.
There are age restrictions on certain diagnoses.
Yeah, because we're talking about a diagnosis Bible that's, what, an inch, 2 inches thick?
I think it's bigger than that now.
Yeah, it's just fucking massive.
It's ridiculous. There are certain age restrictions. Typically, it's somebody has to exhibit symptoms within a certain age range. So somebody who comes in who's 40 years old and they say that they think they have ADHD, you have to look back to say, okay, did they have ADHD when they were 12? And if they didn't have the criteria or symptoms before the age of 12, which can be difficult to get in an older adult, then they typically don't have ADHD, and we have to look at, okay,
unless trauma was involved. Unless the trauma was involved, it can spawn up later, right?
Well, no. Then that would be trauma. We're not dealing with ADHD. We're dealing with trauma that's affecting your attention.
Right, or a predisposition not yet exposed, then exposed by the trauma.
Typically doesn't happen with ADHD. ADHD is something that's always there.
Keep putting holes in it, baby. That's it. I'm just telling you, this happened to me, so it has to be.
You're not going to just have like a traumatic incident at 30 years old and be like, oh, I have ADHD now.
Thank you.
No, what's happening is that, you know, you have ADHD from childhood. It is something that typically you're born with.
And I heard they dropped the age.
The official diagnosis is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The old diagnosis was attention deficit disorder, which does not exist.
Right. They added the H, and so they dropped the ADD.
It does, but there are subtypes such as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder of the inattentive type, or of the combined type, both hyperactive, and so they split the diagnosis into four or five different.
Yeah, have we lost you all yet? This is what it's like reading that diagnosis manual. More questions, man. We're going to be here a minute.
Yeah, no, this is great. I love the questions. We're educating people like me.
So, Chris again and Sebastian, actually, I think, Chris, I'll answer yours myself, Chris, but I want to entertain Sebastian's here because it's kind of on target of what we're talking about is relating to communication. Is verbal language one of the biggest limitations toward creating diagnosis for both children and adults?
Didn't you say you were going to answer that one?
No.
Oh, okay.
I will.
I find it is. For a couple of reasons. It is a roadblock. It's not impossible. For one, if a child or an adult cannot verbally express what they're feeling and thinking, you know, it's terribly frustrating for them because nobody understands. And there's nothing worse in the world, all of us know, is nobody understanding us.
Wow, trapped in that box screaming.
It's very isolating. And I've heard children who've grown up and said, you know, nobody understood me as a child. So I think the verbal part is a very difficult thing. Patience is the key. Trying to help them communicate is also the key.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think we're back to that self-report. All we have when we're left to rely on the self-report, mm-hmm. you know, is what we say to ourselves, what the patient tells us, mm-hmm. what they're able to verbalize is really happening.
Yeah.
You know, that limit. That's why I always talk about telling people to keep journals, man. I kept that journal for so many years, and mm-hmm. my book's spawned out of it. Mm-hmm. But that journal allows you to kind of go back and investigate bullshit feelings, thoughts, mm-hmm. you know, rampages. For
evidence
sure.
Evidence in court.
Hey, sorry. That's why I said in the book, no names. It listed all this shit in my journal with no fucking names, man. Chris, I can answer that for you. It's what do you think are the best steps to take for putting some cognitive therapy on, basically to yourself? So some techniques. I'll pull one right from my book for you, Chris, and then I'll add a little Leoism on top of it for you. Cognitive therapy is essentially being able to be aware of what you're actually thinking, then assess the actual literal thought itself to see if it's rational. So you may have a thought that this fucking guy always pisses me off, and then you're kind of going, okay, it sounds rational because of my past experiences, but then again, you did say always, mm-hmm. and so there's some days he's not pissing you off. And so you're really trying to prove the way you feel to be correct. So there's a couple ways to look at it. I'll give you a few tips. RSA is what I'm talking about. It's called Rational Self-Analysis. It's a tool to change in the book. There's a little easy to apply process, but as you get later in life, right, you look over something quick. So I found a really fast way from Leo to get around all the psychobabble about how to apply some cognitive behavioral therapy, which essentially means how do you get to your truth faster and not decide or respond from emotion? How do you get to the real belief that you have inside? And it's sometimes whatever you do, whatever happens to you in any event, whatever that activating event is, you can pause in the moment and simply, when in doubt, do what you would advise. Pick somebody that you love unconditionally in your life, your children, or somebody you love so much, and then all you simply is ask yourself is if they were bringing you this problem and said, hey, I need advice for what to do here, whatever you would tell them immediately, don't think. Whatever that advice is, quickly, that's the closest to your truth as you're ever going to get. The rest is going to be emotion because you wouldn't lead them wrong. You're going to try to pull from your wisdom. And that's the closest you'll get. And so that's the easiest way I can explain to you to get around the psychobabble of be aware of what you say, how you say it, reframe the thought to be rational.
That was the easy way to get around the psychobabble. I would have painted to hear the psychobabble with that.
Oh, I was about to go off on it.
I think the easiest way is to read. You know, buy the book Cognitive Rampage.
I love it. Yeah, do that.
You know, other CBT things such as Feeling Good by David Burns. It's been around for 30 years plus. That is a good book, kind of breaking things down.
A Guide to Rational Living by Dr. Howard Ellis. That was the teacher to me, to all cognitive. His ABCs helped me.
Here's the thing about cognitive behavioral therapy. Everybody does it. And they all explain it in different ways. And I can, you know, I've had people who go to therapists who say, you know, hey, I've been taught this, but it never really hit me until you explained it. So I think part of it is there's some dynamics between you and a therapist or you, whoever you read.
Good point.
That, you know, for example, Albert Ellis really hit you hard. You know, rational emotive behavioral therapy.
Got me.
I learned a little bit more from Aaron Beck.
Yeah.
You know, cognitive theory. Which I think and read about cognitive theory, cognitive behavioral theory, rational emotive behavioral therapy. I think you have to find the person who touches your heart and opens your mind in a way that nobody has, because you'll read things and say, okay. And then you'll read something from somebody who just hits you a different way and you're like, oh my God, I got it. And it may come from a book, it may come from the internet, it may come from, you know, sometimes they have cognitive techniques workbooks at, you know, a bookstore online you can buy and work through. But I'd say just do your own research and educate yourself, and you have to find the right one for you.
Yeah, well, I used to, another easy example, Chris, for you, I used to use in the clinic to explain is if you're walking. And I use Ellis's ABCs, man, which is simple. For every activating event that happens, you have a belief, B. Based on that belief, there's a consequence. So look at every action, A, that happens. You have a belief based on that action. How you respond to that belief is your consequence. So if I'm walking down the street and some dude bangs into my shoulder and, you know, knocks me off my feet almost a little bit, if that's the activating event and my belief is he disrespected me, how dare he do that? No one's going to, you know, run into me like that and not apologize or buy me new shoes. And then I may turn around based on that belief, and my consequence may be what? You know, I get in a fight, you know, he shoots me, right? I don't know my consequence, but I know I feel angry because of that thought that I have. So based on the activating event, I have a belief that creates my feeling, therefore I create my consequence. I'm walking down the street, dude bangs into me, that's the activating event. If I catch the belief that I'm going to whoop this mother, and I catch that belief up front because I'm responsible for what I do with that automatic thought, and then I process it and say, what if he's late for a funeral? What if his daughter needs to be picked up? Well, I may turn around with that belief, and my consequence may be me saying, I'm sorry, man. So we choose what the belief is based on the activating event.
I think we alter the belief because it goes back to free will.
Boom.
Bam.
And how do you open? You had to drop one last one little street fighter on there, man. Oh, shit.
We'll get out of the show without a Street Fighter reference.
No, or a Pink Floyd shirt.
There you go.
Shout out. Tim, man, what's up? Scott, holy shit. Scott, when you have him back on the show, man? I sent you a message a while ago, Scott. If you guys haven't listened, go back to Scott Perlman's episode, too, man, dropping bombs. Chris, okay, my main chick. Boom, all right. Woo. Family, I'm getting fucked via the partner, full for build. I'm now, I'm fucking lost. Makes sense, shit. Yeah, I do. It messaged me, Chris. Yeah, or I can forward you to Dr. Parker. Nah, he's just got regular life shit, man. I see where he's getting to. I get it.
Well, I think that's
strikes me as a man that really gives a shit.
We all have regular life shit. We all struggle. You know, life is difficult, so I think that's something we can all share in.
I thought you were about to go off on a rampage, man. I was about to sit back and be like, here it comes. Here it comes, man. We've been dropping them all day, man. So, you sure you don't want to talk about Trump politics and porn?
Hey, that is a great tagline for the next show. Trump and porn research.
No, Trump politics and porn. Trump's a whole other fucking world, man. You can analyze politics, then you can analyze Donald Trump, man. I'm telling you, if I could make like a little rat and give him a personality, I would give him Donald Trump's personality. I'd study the fuck out of that shit. I'd be like, look at that motherfucker go.
Right.
He has some fucked up hair. Yeah. Oh, man. That's for real, though. I like that. All right, so the next title when you come back is Trump Politics and Porn.
Hey, yeah, there's some really interesting research on porn and how it changes your brain chemistry.
Oh, that's why I'm nuts. I figured it out. I figured it out, man. Oh, man, that's why the whole country's nuts. That's why the spectrums are widened. That's why we're all on fucking drugs. 60% of America takes a pill to go to sleep. 40% takes a pill when they wake up in the morning. We're all on pharmaceuticals. We're walking around replacing our arms with robotic fucking things. We don't give a shit. We're willing to give up real life feelings and sunsets for virtual reality, transpersonalism, and sacrifice the feeling of a real orgasm for some bullshit jack-off session with some lubed-up toy. But I'm not in the fucking mood, man. If that's what happens, fucking kill me. Because I'm not willing to live like that, man. I don't want immortality. I want, for sure, infinite. This is all going away. So the joys that I get from those demises, I want it. Fucking soak in. All the way to the end, man.
Well, that's cheery.
It isn't my world, man. It isn't my fucking world, damn it. It is. That's a beautiful perception to me, man. Some days, man.
You know, I watch that show, The Cosmos, where, you know, they always zoom out and they show you all these millions of galaxies. And sometimes it gives people anxiety to watch that, but then, you know, how big everything is. And I derive a great deal of comfort because I think about just how insignificant I am and that what I do really doesn't matter.
And I confront it, but I'm like really being mean. I'm like, yeah, you're fucking totally insignificant, man. Isn't that awesome?
I find a great deal of peace knowing that, you know, and I think it takes the importance off of every behavior we do that, you know, it doesn't really matter all that much in the grand scheme of billions of universes.
Proceed, sir.
No, that was it.
That's it.
I thought you were going to pick up some Cosmos.
I leaned back, brother. I was like, oh, shit. That was deep, and I like it. See, you're smarter than me. You can drop something hardcore in like two sentences. I need like 16 bars. It's a big difference, man.
Well, that's why you have a radio show.
Something like that, yeah.
And a book.
Yeah, the second one will be out. And now 30 days, I pushed it back, man.
Okay.
good risk. Rolling the dice.
It's like fine wine. It takes a while to make perfection, I think.
Yeah, and I don't think I'll ever make a book of perfection, but that would be irrational, because ever, there's a chance. I'll take the one in the million Dumb and Dumber scene, man.
I think you're going backwards. I think it's good you let go of the idea of perfection.
Yeah, for sure. I think most people do. I can tell you that night that I referred to a few times, man, on enough psychedelics, sitting in the desert in the Joshua Tree, man, looking up, dog, it was that feeling of insignificant that you talk about overtook me, which gave me this peace. Mm-hmm. It almost felt good to be like, I don't fucking matter at all.
Yeah.
And I was like,
takes the pressure off.
Yeah, I was kind of like, that's fucking great. You know, but not to the, you know, it's hard. It's definitely, it's beautiful that it's almost like a spawn to another level, I guess, when you see that, you know. Mm-hmm. And then we come back to our social constructs of what we create. We assign meaning to things. We have thumbs and we see patterns and we fuck our own shit up, man.
I think everybody ought to take a social media detox. You know, and those things are becoming more and more popular, and it's, you know, turning off your social media for 30 days.
Well, I have a good idea.
Put your phone in a lockbox when you come home or something like that, because it is really, really, you can tell a detox, and you can tell withdrawals from social media or from internet or things like that.
Yeah, I'm going to need a Xanax. That's what motherfuckers say. Look, hear me now. Believe me later, bro. You're going to see a cigarette and cell phone rehab, and it's going to make more money than any dual diagnosis Medicaid, Medicare facility has ever made.
I treat a lot of internet and electronic addictions.
No, we're a center just for that. 30 days inpatient, no cigarettes, no cell phone.
I believe I looked into a video game addiction center.
We'll add that.
It was in California. They need something on the East Coast for sure.
We got to incorporate that too. Yeah. Video games, all the odd things that people make fun of that you and I both know fuck a motherfucker's life up.
Yeah.
I like that.
There's a lot out there. It is a problem.
No, we're going to make the first one.
Okay.
Yeah, the first.
No, I mean, a lot of problems out there. Centers, yeah.
Definitely not a lack of patience. Job market's widening thanks to the DSM.
Yeah.
Hey, man, shout out your shit, man. I think we're through with the questions people killed. We probably not worth still going. But
oh, yeah. Thanks for having me on. You know, Dr. Parker Mott. You can visit my website at www.counselingcfl.com. I'm the owner of Counseling and Psychological Services of Central Florida, located in Winter Garden. You can also follow that specific name on Facebook, Twitter, Google+.
And thank you for listening to 580 WDBO. That is Dr. Parker
Mott.
We are sponsored by Counseling and Psychological Services of Winter Garden, Florida, where at any time you can call and no. Oh, man.
My phone will start blowing up later.
Right. Yeah.
50 messages Monday morning.
Oh, man. I had something to say, but I just imagined it was like radio and you were doing this ad for, what was I going to, oh, man. I don't know. Must have been a lot. No, I think we're going to have to build some website for you that's literally like the backcountry doctor. .com. I keep referring to you that. I'm going to make that fucking name thick, man.
I know, right? It's my, you know, title on all of the podcasts here. How many times have I been on here? I've been on several times now. I really am a guinea pig for the new things.
Yeah, you are. You are, and I appreciate that. Your episode 2, the first episode, was just me talking shit for like 4 minutes. And then the first episode was you and Eric.
We've had some memorable ones, yeah. And
yeah, there's one we didn't post.
There's one that we didn't post.
Eric, I'll post that episode if you don't come on and give me a new one. How about that for blackmail? And I know Eric's response to blackmail. He's like, fuck it, post it.
I think that needs to be on the uncut DVD one day. Something that's an R1 or something.
I think they do DVDs anymore, man.
Whatever it is. Try not to be connected. I'm always on the internet. I don't know.
Yeah, Eric, you have to come back on the show. Otherwise, that uncut episode part, like 85, that you, me, and Parker did, like 85 drinks in, it's going to go live.
I think that the cognitive theory one was really good, too, that you and me did. That explained kind of the ins and outs of cognitive therapy and, what is it, episode 20?
Well, we had something like this planned, and unfortunately, man, remember Pulse happened.
That was one of the best shows I think you've ever done. That was, I mean, we were sitting in the studio with tears running down our face because it was days.
Yeah, bro. We were right there, bro. Yeah.
And we got really good feedback. I think we helped a lot of people. We helped people see it in a different way. I think we helped people process anger. I think we were going to do, like, the psychology of politics in that show.
Oh, by the way, there's a small local activism group going on that's connected to Pulse Nightclub and, what's the other, is it Revolution or it used to be Southern Nights?
Oh, yeah.
And what they're trying to do is the city is trying to purchase that bar from the owners and make it a memorial. And the owner obviously doesn't want to sell because they have to keep it open.
Yeah.
Right. So I know they were trying to, they were really not being paid attention to. They were trying to bring it up to the forefront, you know, that, hey, you know, let them keep it open, you know, as the memorial.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's a difficult thing to know what to do there.
I'm not on that council for that.
It's a bad
decision. I mean, I know what to do is let the man own his property, you know. I mean, I think him running it continuously saying you can't shut us down despite, you know, I'll take
the fight. I could be wrong on this. I think one of the issues related to it was the money that the city wanted to pay was substantially less than what.
Imagine that.
So I think
imagine that, too.
I think that the owner initially agreed to it, but it was just too big of a loss for him at that point. So,
yeah.
I don't know if it was money or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think we need to put it all aside and just try and figure out a solution to all of this that's respectful and can serve everybody.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that was a tough show. That show I didn't expect. You know, they were like coming over. We had a whole show planned. Just dove into that. But
it was.
I think we covered all, but next time we are definitely doing Trump politics and porn with the backcountry doctor. I
have to write that down. I've got a lot on it, too.
You are going to write it down, too.
We'll bring magazines.
Magazines. I'll bring my DVD porn. All right, you bring your magazine porn. Look, people, you got to be a little out of your mind to help people that are out of their minds, all right? So you just get to see how we really talk when you guys aren't around with therapists and shit. Are like, yeah, we're out of our minds, but guess what? I talk to them. No, we don't. We really don't.
We've had a great time.
I'm trying to fix it when I leave my phone. Not wanting to start it. Ooh. Yeah, definitely messaged me. My brother Chris.
Yeah.
Man, this has been like 2 hours, hasn't it? Been killing.
We have. Has it been 2 hours? Usually our shows go about
we can
hour
keep
and
going,
a half.
Man, that doesn't mean we either have to have another beer or do you get? I'm flying or screwed. I don't know. Well, we're falling off here.
I think we've kind of run out. Yeah.
Yeah. We could talk. We could keep talking, bro. Come on.
Nobody's watching anymore.
I am, bitch. No. Oh, cool, man. Well, fuck. Shut it down, then, bro. Oh, Steve, I miss you here, man.
Yeah,
love you,
Steve, the maestro.
Yeah, appreciate y'all watching. That's the first full podcast we tried. End up doing part two. We may do it some more when we're in the studio.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah. Peace.